Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, roll call.
Councilmember Richards.
Here.
Councilmember Bennett.
Here.
Councilmember Aceves.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tempore Kasdan.
Here.
Mayor Perotti.
Here. Okay, at this time, I would like to ask for a moment of silence for Corey Iverson, who was a firefighter who lost his life in the Thomas Fire. Thank you. Okay, at this time we'll have public forum. Anybody that wishes to speak to anything that's not on our agenda today?
There are no speakers.
Oh, I forgot report from closed session. Mr. Jenkins.
Mayor, apparently after your December 5th regular meeting, you adjourned to a closed session on December 7th. In order to discuss the city manager performance evaluation. And so you did that, and there was no reportable action taken from that closed session. And that brings us up to today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Now we'll go to public forum. Anybody that wishes to speak to anything that's not on our agenda?
There are no speakers.
Okay. Amendments and adjustments.
Madam Mayor, we have no amendments or adjustments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Presentation, Thomas Fire Update, Santa Barbara County Fire Department.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Eric Peterson. I'm the Santa Barbara County Fire Chief. And it is also a huge pleasure, and I take a lot of pride in the fact that I'm also called the City of Goleta Fire Chief. So thanks for having me here today to update you on the Thomas Fire. I want to start by thanking you and your city for what you have provided in assistance on this fire. These kinds of huge events like this truly are a collaborative, truly demand collaborative approach. And your city has been a huge part of this thing, even though you haven't been directed or directly impacted by the actual fire. You have been impacted by the smoke and the ash, of course. But you've taken in evacuees, you've taken in animals, and maybe more important than anything else, you have contributed personnel to the EOC in an extremely valuable way. I see Ann Wells here. I don't think that there has been a time that I have gone into that EOC since this incident started where I haven't seen Ann Wells or Valerie Kuznarov. There's Valerie right there. Vito Adamidis has been there. Let's see. Dennis Loist with your GIS section, and Joanne Plummer. And I think there's probably some people that I've missed, but we really are in this together, and the City of Goleta has shown that, and it didn't go unnoticed, and we really do appreciate it. So thank you for that. I also want to thank, of course, our firefighters who have done such a good job on this thing. They've been involved from the top to the bottom of it and made a pretty substantial impact, and our sheriff's personnel. They've been great. They've had really difficult circumstances to deal with, and nobody wants to be kicked out of their house or kept from their house, and they've done that spectacularly well again. So we appreciate all those people. So a quick rundown on this fire. We'll go to the perimeter map. Where we are now, just some sort of interesting facts. This fire is now at 271,750 acres. I have with me also, I should mention, our fire marshal, Steve Oakes, who's going to fill in the blanks for the areas that I can't cover. My understanding is that this is the third largest fire in California history. Am I correct in that, Steve?
By a couple hundred acres right now.
Right. And there is some speculation that it will that it has the potential by the end of the next couple of days to be the largest. They're doing a fairly large, they're tying in a big corner of the 33 up on the north end of the fire, and that will add significantly to the acreage. So it does have the potential to be the largest fire in California history. So right now, the cost of this fire is over $140 million, which is another record. There have been over 8,000 personnel assigned to the fire. although I think we're going to see that number decrease significantly as we wind this thing down. And that's, of course, a very good sign as we send local government personnel back to their home units. Interestingly, since the beginning of October, the only measurable rain we've had is a tenth of an inch. And other than that, there has not been any significant rain for over 280 days, which is another unfortunate record and I'm sure has contributed to the ferocity of this incident. So where we are right now on this perimeter, where the west end of it is right here, and it's basically, it's hung up right just east of Gibraltar Road. This really nice break in the weather that we're experiencing right now has given us some beautiful clear air. And because of that, we have had zero wind in the last couple of days, and we've had the ability to get crews and resources down in there and go direct to the fire. It's also given us the opportunity to utilize the Type 1 helicopter asset that we have had in place but haven't been able to use because the area has been so smoked in or too windy. So we have a mobile retardant base set up at the Bridge to Nowhere at the bottom of 154. And I'm sure if you guys have driven by there, you've seen those big old sky cranes. They look like praying mantises. Those things have the ability to drop 2,500 gallons of water or retardant. So it makes a big impact to be able to have those things there, and they make a very targeted approach. We've also had the super scoopers that have flown in. They carry 2,600 gallons, I think, and they have a really quick turnaround, which, you know, they don't have to land to reload. They just come in and scoop and away they go. So they were coming in yesterday, I think. They were making a drop, I think, about every 15 minutes for an extended amount of time. So it's making a very big impact on the fire. We've also had the kind of recent benefit of repurposed military technology, where there's a drone called a Raptor that was, of course, developed for military use, but it has a very precise infrared capability. It's at about 30,000 feet, which keeps it well out of the air operations for the incident, keeps it well above all that kind of stuff, but it allows people on the ground to be able to see exactly where the hot spots are in this fire. And we've been able to use that to really good effect during this fire, because we've been able to map the locations of those hot spots via GIS and put them directly on the map and then direct water drops and crews into those exact locations. And, you know, that's a capability we didn't have even 10 years ago, that we didn't have that precise a capability. So that's been a really help. So we'll go to the progression map next, and I can circle back on any of these if I need to. I want to direct your attention to the dark green area down there on the bottom. Oops, I'll go over here. This area here. That was December 5th. That was a 63,000 acre run. And then December 10th was this kind of yellow, light green area over here. These are huge, huge runs for a 124 hour period, unprecedented in our history, these fire runs. To put it into perspective, you know, we had the Sherpa fire, which was 7,500 acres right above your city. We had the Alamo fire, and of course we had the Whittier fire, which was also right above your city. Just one of these runs was more than all three of those fires combined, which is just amazing. You know, this is something new in our experience. The sheer size and speed of this fire is something that we've never seen at any other time. The fact that you can drive out of the 101 and drive 75 miles an hour for almost a half an hour and not see the end of this thing is just something we just have never seen before. Another interesting fact is that the Zaca fire, which prior to this in Santa Barbara, that was the largest fire in our history. It took 2 months to get to 240,000 acres, and this fire did it in a week, which is unprecedented. I think this is a fairly new map. We showed it the other night at one of the community briefings, but it bears repeating because of this big blob here, this red blob That's 11,000, almost 11,500 acres. That happened on the morning, Saturday morning, when we had the big firefight above Montecito. And I have a couple of pictures of that towards the end of this. But that is a huge, huge amount of fire that will occur in 6 hours or maybe even less. And the fact that that wind-driven fire was able to be stopped, oh, there goes my, right here, see all these little black dots, those are homes. That fire was, for the most part, it squirted out a little bit right here, but it was for the most part stopped right there above East Mountain Drive. It would not have done that. It would not have stopped had we not had over 200 fire trucks and well over 1,000 personnel in there who were well acquainted with the dirt, had been able to make themselves very familiar with the escape routes and where they could plug in and where the water sources were. We had the benefit of a mass quantity of resources, and they were trained, they were properly briefed, they had good accountability for their people, they had good accountability for themselves. And the fact that we were able to not only stop that fire and keep the structure loss to a relative minimum, although some people did lose everything, which is always terrible, the fact that over 1,000 homes in there made it out okay is, I think, really a testament to the planning and the pre-planning that went into this fire and our access to resources and these people who are best in the business. So that's a big success. And here are some pictures of Saturday morning. These all came from Mike Eliason. I think that one on the right I might have taken on my way down the pass. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Dave Zanaboni played that for me today to this picture. And these are just some of the pictures that some of the things that crews were having to deal with. This is sort of an interesting thing that Eliason found for me. This shows the perimeter of the fire compared to Maui down here, the San Francisco Bay. It's not showing up too well on this PowerPoint. Chicago. It's hard to put into perspective just how big this thing is. It's really large. And then finally, I'll leave on some Thomas Fire information. But that's all I have for this morning. Again, for this afternoon, I thank you very much for your time. And between myself and my fire marshal, I think we can answer any questions that you might have.
Councilmember Seves.
Thank you. First, Chief, I want to thank you for your leadership. It was very calming, just like right now. How you can tell the message and bring the emotions down that people are involved. I remember back to the Coyote Fire. That's how long I've been around here and seen many fires. And many of our Q&As for the public and the media were basically in parking lots. I mean, we did it at DP parking lot many times. But what was so impressive this year was to have the cooperation from KUIT that went live at 4 o'clock, and everybody knew that 4 o'clock you can get an update.
Right.
I stayed home. I didn't need to go down there. I saw everything perfectly from my house. But the information that was given was absolutely fantastic. It was timely. And then at one point when it was really burning hot, I mean burning hot, but one of the high points in this fire, there were about 5 or 6 radio stations that went live with Key News' broadcast, and one of them actually was in Spanish. So, I think you guys have set the bar pretty high on future events and communicating with the public. I just had 2 quick questions, and the fires that we've had in prior years, unfortunately, we were competing with other fires. So was this not the case here? That's why we had so many resources come in so quickly, because this is really the only game in town at that point?
That's a great question. And a lot of the time, when you are the only game in town, you get access to a lot of resources that you otherwise might not have. What happened during this fire is the whole state kind of was simultaneously. There was fires down south in San Diego, if you remember. And because of the potential that this fire had and the fact that it was menacing so much life and property, we became sort of a priority you don't necessarily want, but we became the number one priority in the state. And so That gave us immediate access to the lion's share of air resources, ground resources, and that really is how we were able to get so much equipment in here so fast. Our mutual aid system in the state of California, actually in the nation, it's not perfect, but it's pretty darn good. It's a model for the rest of the world.
Then one comment and one final question. I remember one of the press briefings, it was discussed how our communities divided up into like little districts, and each one had a number.
Right.
I wish there was a way we can get that out to the public. Instead of spending time saying, you know, from 154 to here to there, to saying these districts are now in the warning area. And I don't know how we do that, but I think that's a challenge for the future. You know, maybe put on our tax bill or something. You're in zone, whatever it is, so that we know that we are affected more quickly if we give a number out.
That's a really good idea.
And then my final question, and it may be a simple answer, but I don't have, you know, I guess I probably should have asked this before, but I've been asked why we don't use ocean water. Why do we need fresh water? I mean, we got a full ocean out there that we can scoop and drop. Is that a last minute, or is that a equipment thing that we can't use salt water?
You know, I have to be honest. I'm not a subject matter expert on the super scoopers, but I what little I know is that ocean water is really corrosive and hard on their equipment. And when you have a freshwater source as close as Kachuma Lake, I think they just prefer to use that.
That makes sense. Thank you very much, and thank you again for your
thank
leadership.
You very much.
Mayor Pro Tem Kasdan.
Hi. I also want to thank you for your leadership and what you guys have all done. Obviously, it's early for a kind of retrospective or postmortem. But are there lessons? I mean, since we have you here, are there things for us, lessons as far as prevention, pre-planning, and those things that, given, you know, that this was so distinctive, so unusual, I don't know, what do we take away from it?
The main takeaway for me is... This incident was, especially on the 10th when it made that big run, it got ahead of us to a certain extent. We predicted that it was going to happen, but I think maybe it got ahead of us by about 12 hours. I think even those of us who have been here for a long, long time, and my colleagues up in the Forest Service, we're always talking amongst ourselves about how everything's different. You know, here we are in December, 19th today. And we're still in high fire season, and humidity is 2% up there in some places. I think the main takeaway is we need to internalize and institutionalize that things really are different now. And whatever you want to call this thing that's happening, whether you want to call it climate change or, you know, some weather pattern that is going to be with us for some amount of time, it's here, and things are different, and we need to adjust accordingly. When it comes to prevention and when it comes to fire suppression.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Councilmember Bennett.
Yeah, I too wanted to add my thanks for all the work and efforts of all the fire agencies, law enforcement agencies, and all of the other support agencies such as the Red Cross, et cetera, that makes all these things work. And the thing I think it's important for the community to know, it doesn't just happen. It comes because of all the extensive training and all of the work that's gone on over the years to improve the ability to communicate and understand common resources and so on. And that all began back in 1970 with the fire siege that occurred at that time. And so I think that's, you know, really, really important. I wanted to thank also the insight of the community outreach meetings. I think those were critically important. Mm. I had the pleasure of speaking to a number of people, and I suggested that they watch it at 4 o'clock, which was easy because it was the same time, you know, and so everybody was able to really dial into that, as Councilmember Seva said. I mean, I think that was a real positive, and people felt comfortable because they were able to get the information. Even when it wasn't good, they got the information nonetheless, and they were alerted as to the potential in the future. Such as the Wynn event that did come forward, but in fact you were prepared for. The proof is the few lost structures that occurred. If you weren't prepared, that it would have been much more disastrous, which is so often the case with wildland fires. But I think you touched on something when you say that we're in a different world. as the reports are compiled and we end up with a final report on the Sonoma County incidents and the city of Santa Rosa, and where it burnt into the city. I mean, that wasn't the forest. That wasn't the brushlands. It burnt down shopping centers. It burnt down housing all over. And so I think people really need to understand, just because you don't live adjacent to the brushlands does not necessarily mean you are protected from an incident that is fueled by 60, 70, 80 mile an hour winds. Theirs are called Diablo winds, like our sundowners.
Right.
So I think that's critically important, and I think your emphasis on we're in a different time right now and a different weather pattern, everyone needs to be really alert as to what's going on out there. And the maps that you put out on the previous fires, which went back to 1999, I know there were a few that I spoke with who were scratching their head because they had remembered fires in the area that this burned that had burned earlier. And I said, that's correct. And so, because some people were saying none of this area had been burnt since 1933. Hmm. And in fact, it had been burnt in the 1971 Romero Canyon fire, as an example. And then the Wheeler fire that came from Ojai, much like this one, and blew into our county behind Carpinteria and a portion of Montecito. And that was in 1985. So the area has been touched by fire frequently. And then, of course, as previously mentioned, the 1964 Coyote fire, which burnt much of the area that has been burnt, and also the T and the Jesus Cita, et cetera. So we've seen a lot of fire in our front country here. And one of the other questions that I've been asked, well, does this mean we can do control burns now? And I said, well, that's something to be determined. And I'm hopeful that if the state of California can get it together, that we will have the means to be able to take these young fuels and keep them under control, as opposed to letting them grow for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and with all the dieback that's associated with that, and then have a conflagration as what we've been experiencing. So I leave that in your lap as you go forward on how that might be safely instituted for the future, because we know that there will be young fuels that will begin to grow. Everything will start to come back. It's amazing. In a matter of weeks, even without rain, things begin to start growing. It's just an amazing process. So I leave that with you, and I hope that you and your colleagues maybe can work on that while we have this opportunity.
Well, thanks.
And again, thank you.
Couldn't agree more.
Councilmember Richards.
Well, hello. I don't have much to add other than just to echo the depth of the gratitude of us on behalf of the city and the entire community, the Santa Barbara Ventura community, for the valiant efforts of your crews. In particular, I also wanted to echo the sentiment of the daily briefings and how valuable they have been, and attending them myself also. It impressed on me just how coordinated everything was. You know, multiple agencies representing, you know, various, you know, community groups, Red Cross and others, and Food Bank, as well as public service, fire, you know, all across the board. And it was great and comforting and, you know, reassuring to see all the groups there working together so well. So thank you
for being really appreciate the feedback.
Well, I know that you're really busy, but I want to thank you too. I know I have before, but I want to echo what my colleagues have said. We really appreciate the hard work that everyone is doing out there and keeping us all safe, and just the information that has been getting out to us so quickly, and I think it's really appreciated. I know I hear from folks in the community that they really appreciate that. But the one thing that I do hear a lot, people are calling and texting, or I see on Facebook, is they want to do something for you, the firefighters. And I know at the briefing yesterday, I believe it was mentioned that you have everything. You have your food, and you have your toiletries and underwear. So is there anything that was mentioned? Is there anything that the community can do to help? Or is there anything they could do to help you?
You know, I appreciate that question, and you're correct. The firefighters are getting everything they need. They're very well, you know, they're being well supplied and well fed at the base camps. I don't know if you've seen any of those lunches, those bags. Each one of them literally weighs 5 pounds. I just think everybody feels the outpouring of support from this community. I mean, everywhere I go, you know, one of our ICs, Rocky Opliger, was saying, man, I can't buy a cup of coffee in this town right now, you know. And so everybody involved in this incident feels that sense of gratitude and appreciation. And I think we're fine. You know, it's nice to be appreciated. We really are doing our job, but it really is nice to be appreciated for it. And we thank you for that.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you.
Item A1, acceptance of the November 2017 check register. A2, approval of memorandum of understanding with the Black Gold Cooperative Library System. A3, professional design services agreements with Kimley Horn and Associates, Inc. for the rectangular rapid flashing beacons at Chapel and pedestrian hybrid beacons at Kingston and the rectangular rapid flashing beacon improvements at school crossing projects. A4, amendment number 2 for professional services with M6 Consulting. A5, amendments to contracts with Kimley Horn and M&S Engineers for preparation of a development impact fee study. A6, notice of completion for the fiscal year 2017-18 pavement prep and slurry project. A7, amendment number 1 to the professional design services agreement 2016-114 with TJKM for professional design services for the Hollister Avenue Complete Streets Corridor Plan project. A8, amendment number 3 to the agreement for professional services with Rincon Consultants, Inc. for energy support services. A9, amendment number 1, professional services agreement for planning and environmental review department document imaging program services with Linda Gregory. A10, amendment number 2 to the professional service agreement 2016-154 with Philippin Engineering, Inc. for construction management services for the Cathedral Oaks landscaping project. A11, amendment number 4 to the professional design services agreement with Rick Engineering Company for the Ward Drive Class 2 bike lanes project. A12, award of contract for a parks, facilities, and playgrounds master plan.
Thank you. Council wish to pull any item from the consent calendar.
Yeah, A12.
Councilmember Richards?
Madam Mayor,
it's me.
staff needs to pull item A2 and item A8 for a brief clarification.
So A2 and A8,
yes.
Correct?
Yes, that's okay. Correct.
Okay, so motion to approve A1, A2. Oh, wait, we're pulling A2. A3. A4, A5, A6, A7, A9, A10, A11.
So moved.
Okay. Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. So A2.
Madam Mayor and council members, staff noted that on page 4 of item A2, in the paragraph right under the table there, it notes that Goleta staff are preparing a separate report for council on December 19th, to consider adoption of classification specifications for the various library positions. That date should be January 16th, 2018. So we wanted to be clear that we're bringing those at our next council meeting. And that's why you don't see it in your packet here. So that's the only clarification on that item we needed to make.
Okay. Motion to approve.
Move approval. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. The next one was
A8.
Okay, Madam Mayor and council members, the recommendation for item A8 had to be amended to include a need for a budget appropriation. So we would like it to read as it appears in your packet with the additional language, which I'll read right now. Authorize a budget appropriation of $145,000 from general fund unassigned fund balance to the advanced planning professional service account 101-5-4300-500. This information was provided in the body of the report and in the fiscal impacts. It just failed to appear in your recommendation, so we apologize for that.
Okay, I need a motion.
Move approval as amended.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay, now we're looking at A12.
Yeah. So I was sort of wondering, as far as this one indicates, it's the contractor is going to prioritize all future projects associated with Parks and Master Plan. And so my first question associated with that is the, if why don't you explain, because it seems to me that that seems like a policy question as opposed to something that the council would determine what our priorities are for parks, as opposed to the a consultant doing it. And I recognize we had a survey that was done previously, the rec needs survey, but that's still only a limited tool. And so I'm curious as far as how the interplay is.
Sure. Thank you, Councilmember Kasdan. To respond to your question about whether or not it's a council decision to prioritize our projects, it definitely is a council decision. The Parks Master Plan will be coming before council for adoption, and it will also be coming to council at your request throughout the process for updates and status reports. And at any time, if we needed to shift the direction, we could do so. But it is definitely, once it comes to council, will be a final council decision. The consultant will be providing a recommendation to us, and they will also be taken into consideration all of the existing studies and plans that the city has already done, so that, because a lot of those decisions have been made, and then adding upon that regarding our parks projects.
Well, I guess I'm, you know, what I certainly do not want to see is a final product being handed to us to sign off or otherwise react to. That I think, you know, there should be some role for us in directing the consultant to pursue certain things, to that we highlight things that are our priorities for us. And let me elaborate on one in particular that I think we've talked about before, is that I think in Old Town there's a considerable lack of park space, and that I think it's important that there be nearby park space for people. And as much, you know, it breaks up a very dense community when there's a playground or other sorts of things near houses. It's not enough to just have a large park that people can perhaps drive to or otherwise is, you know, elsewhere. For that reason, and in part for that reason, I think a strategy considering pocket parks is important, and that pocket parks offer an opportunity to get lots in a neighborhood that otherwise would not be available if one is waiting for a large area to house a soccer field or something. It will give you potentially playgrounds, community gardens, and other things identified in the rec needs assessment. And so I would want to see in this a prioritization, or at least a recognition that this is an important strategy for us to being able to accomplish our goals.
In response to that question, first of all, I will share that the recreation needs assessment did identify the open active recreation as its number one parks needs, and our CIP budget reflects that. A lot of our improvement projects are enabling us to renovate existing fields, including the current grant that we received from the state to renovate the field adjacent to the community center. So we are addressing that need. If there are other needs, such as pocket parks or other park needs, those can be discussed in the kickoff meetings and in the community meetings that we're planning on facilitating throughout this process. We'll be coming together in January to do our kickoff meeting with staff and the consultants, and then we'll also be putting together our plan plan for community input meetings, which ideas such as addressing pocket parks or other areas can definitely be added to that list.
Well, I want to put this on the table for the council to provide, not necessarily that this is something that staff is going to decide on, and that I don't disagree that large open fields are desirable. But they don't come up that much. We have large backlogs sitting in our bank accounts where we haven't been spending because there isn't, these things aren't readily available. So while I'm not disputing having soccer fields as an ideal sort of acquisition, what I am suggesting is these odd-shaped lots, end lots, things that come up occasionally in neighborhoods are opportunities that it will really improve neighborhoods. And I think I don't want to see us be rigid on that. And so I guess I'd like to see if could I get an additional council member to support that idea. I think for we know what the proportions are of parks to perks per capita in Old Town, and it's the only way we're going to be able to expand some sort of park space, some sort of open space in the area.
Well, let's take questions from Councilmember Seves and then Councilmember Bennett. Come back to that.
Ms. Plummer, I thought your report was pretty clear, but I just want to make sure that we understand what you're asking and the process, because a master plan is the end product to come to council for final review. But according to your report, the consultant is going to basically triage, for lack of a better word, all the work that's been done to this point with all our studies, working with the Parks and Recs Commission. The proposed scope of work includes community outreach, at which the consultant will solicit feedback, and I'm reading from your report, and provide updates to the Parks and Rec Commission in a public meeting, and then again to City Council. Then on page 2, it talks about scope of work, which includes the data collection, analyzing existing conditions, and the last point, future plans and funding, which includes identified locations and costs for future facilities. So I think it's all encompassing, but what you're asking for, unless I'm mishearing this, what you're asking for is a consultant to come forward with us that you've already been working with to put the package together with public input to come back to this council for a master plan review and possible approval. Am I off?
Well, I wouldn't say you're off necessarily, because we have required that our consultant that we have not been working with, this is an award of contract. Okay. They've just submitted a proposal, and in their proposal, all of their scope of work is outlined in the contract. In the staff report, we surmised it so that you didn't have a 20-page staff report along with a 20-page contract. So the consultant will be utilizing what is already existing and then moving us forward. We have added everything into this Parks Master Plan so that it can be a working tool for our staff to use, whether it's our maintenance staff or our planning staff, to include our finance staff, because we not only asked for what are the recommendations based on the practices in the industry standards, best practices across the country, and everything else. We also asked them, how are we going to fund your recommendations? So if you're going to come to us with recommendations based on what our community is saying, based on past reports, how would you recommend that we fund this? So we're asking them also for other recommendations on top of that. In our interviews with our candidates, the statement that kept coming forward was the reality that this is going to be a working document, and that we have included everything to include soil sampling to check for the opportunity for reclaimed water in parks that we are not currently planned for the use of reclaimed water. So we are asking them to do a lot of work and compiling all of our plans together so that when somebody's asking a question, staff or council or community members not referring to 4 or 5 different plans that the city has, but pulling that all together when it comes to parks and open space. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. And when do you anticipate this coming, being all done and coming to us for a final product for review?
We're looking at kicking off in January of 2018 and completing about December of 2018 and possibly bringing the final project to you in January of 2019.
Thank you very much.
Councilmember Bennett.
Going forward, I wanted to thank you. I thought what you are proposing here and recommending is excellent, and I think we've spent a lot of money on previous reports, and as you kind of said, you know, when you have a half a dozen reports laying around out there and you've done a lot of work already, it's sometimes things get missed because they're not all put together in a comprehensive document. So I really appreciate that you recognize that and that we're not just hiring another consultant to put something on the shelf. You know, this will be a comprehensive report and put everything together that we've had in the past. And again, I appreciate that. I appreciate the fact you said as this goes forward, unless I misheard you, you said you will be bringing this to council to give us periodic updates as to where we are. So we surely will be involved if we see something that we'd like to see changed or the direction to be a little different based on these updates, then we'll have certainly the opportunity to suggest that to you. And then to more closely comment on Mayor Pro Tem Kasdan's comments, I've been involved in Old Town for 20 years, more than 20 years, and they only ever had the little pocket park there on Nectarine, which is a 50 by 100 foot park. It's 5,000 square feet. There were no other park spaces. Well, after the city incorporated, and I'm not here to pound my chest, but later on, we did acquire the property on Armitos, which I think is an acre and a half or 2 acres, because it was available, and we turned it into a nice little park for the little kids, and they love it, and they're down there, and I've been there many times watching the kids play, and so I think we did something good, and I've actually gotten some positive comments. The general plan had always envisioned a park at Kellogg and Hollister, and so, and the reason for that was because it was the available land once again. The problem in Old Town, your suggestion is nice throughout the city, but in Old Town it doesn't work because it's built out. There is no, the parcels that we've acquired are the parcels that were available that were not built upon so we could turn them into a little pocket park or into a park. The only other piece of land that's available, and I know our planning section is familiar with it, and that's the Newland, if I'm pronouncing the name of the property owner correctly, which is butts up to the creek on the east side, that's San Jose Creek, and it accesses between Armitos and off of Dearborn. And I believe it's about 4.5 acres, something like that, 5 acres. And that's been looked at over time as a possibility because it's in the floodway and in the floodplain, and to be able to build anything there is going to be very difficult. But that's the only other portion of land that I'm familiar with. Maybe someone else has some other idea of land that's available in Old Town, but I'm not familiar with it. Unless you buy something and tear something down, there is no other parcels available that I'm aware of that we could turn into either a pocket park or a larger park or a natural park or whatever we chose to do. So I think working with the community center, and I know there was discussion about possibly putting a public pool there. That was one of the highest priorities when the surveys were done. You know, I'm certainly open-minded to whatever it looks like, whatever the consultant might suggest to us, and what direction we set as the priority, if we'd like to go for that. I think that's a wonderful thought. But I think we're doing all that we can do in Old Town at this stage of the game, and we still have needs elsewhere in our community where we may have the opportunity to do pocket parks and do some other things that are not there now, but would lend themselves to those kinds of activities. So, again, I just want to thank you. I think it's been really helpful.
Councilmember Richards.
Well, first of all, thank you for the clarification. One of the concerns that I had in reading through the scope of work is that it does seem focused a lot on existing conditions and historical inventory and, like, kind of looking at what's been done already. But I am heartened to hear that it will be looking forward as well and giving ideas and suggestions and helping us to prioritize what we need moving forward. Referring back to, well, first of all, in particular, one thing I would ask of staff moving forward, and I know this isn't something that we need right away, but there's a list of meetings, stakeholder interviews, commission meetings, public workshops, et cetera, that will be required of the consultant. I'd like to see at some point an agenda, you know, a schedule, you know, for how this will be mapped out over the course of the contract with them. I share the concerns that I'd like it to be, you know, an iterative process where we get to see it along the way, that it's not just something. And I don't think that that was ever intended, but just to make it clear, like, you know, where, you know, how will this lay out, and, you know, what will the steps be, and where will the stakeholder interviews be? Where do you anticipate taking it to the Parks and Rec Commission, et cetera? So at some point, I would like to see that. Referring back to the previous comments about pocket parks, I don't remember that coming up in the rec needs assessment per se, and you mentioned that you thought that there was a more focus in that of active open space recreational areas. At the same time, we also have identified, I remember discussions in the past of, you know, looking at the geography and the map of the city, and there being certain underserved areas of the city that might not have access to a field nearby, you know, where that would even be feasible. So I think it's just prudent to, you know, make sure that pocket parks are at least on the table, that we don't immediately discount them, and whether or not we consider them for Old Town or other parts of the city, I think that they should at least be brought up in the discussion, and not just, you know, assume that they're not going to, you know, be of service in anywhere. So
definitely to respond, Councilmember Richards, as mentioned earlier, the recreation needs assessment did identify active recreation as a need for open space. But as I referenced, our current capital improvement project has us renovating multiple park spaces that we currently have, plus the addition of Hollister Kellogg Park's athletic space and the community center park parcel renovation. Those are all helping to meet that need. So the Parks Master Plan will recognize that and then still see if that will continue to be a need, or other park spaces such as an expansion of existing amenities at some parks, or additional pocket park spaces, or additional trails, anything else that the community is still stating today is a need. And then in addition, it is important to note that the timeline for this project is designed to mirror and run alongside the recreation needs assessment, so that when we get to the end life of the recreation needs assessment and the Parks Master Plan, you know, 20 years from now, we can all go back out as a recreation and parks master plan and go forward at that point once these needs have all been met much later on.
Okay. Thank you. Good.
Mayor Pro Tem Kasdan?
So did you just say that acquiring pocket parks would be one of the elements in this, that it would be included in one of the in prioritizing future projects?
We're asking them to look at all park parcels, current and potential existing, and a park can be a pocket park or a large field, large open space, a trail, based on the definition of park. So there is a large variety, and we are going to ask them to look at the entire scope. It's not called out specifically for all the different types in the staff report, but during our kickoff meeting, we will definitely be sitting down asking them to take a look at everything related to parks, open space, and trails in Goleta.
Because I guess, you know, I hear what Councilmember Bennett said, and I think that's well taken. If it's not available, it's not available. But we should keep it on the table for if the opportunity presents itself, because there's both, you know, it's a supply and demand thing in a way for determining what's a priority. It's there's a need, certainly, in Old Town, and if something comes up, we want to have the tools, we want to have the potential to acquire something that comes up for that community. We don't want to have our hands tied because we've decided that that isn't one of our priorities. Just because of the need, it is a priority, even if it isn't expansive or anything like that. And, the pocket parks have some potential, just they're cheaper also. But anyway, go ahead. You had some.
I just would like to thank you as well for your report. I enjoyed reading it, and I'm looking forward to. I like the idea of having an agenda where that we see where you're at and what's happening along the way, and bringing it back to us to take a look at occasionally, so we can all feel like we're a part of it, definitely, and all engaged. I'm going to throw a little something else. I agree the idea of pocket parks, if there was an area that would be able to do that, should be looked at. I would agree with that. I'm going to just throw something else out there, and I don't know if it would be considered in the scope of work, but also just
it's been mentioned several times in different from different folks about just having more gathering places. It's not really a park. It's not a. It's just a place where it could be a picnic table and some chairs underneath a beautiful tree.
Sorry.
But when I think of pocket parks, I also so would you consider that a pocket park as well? I'm not sure if gathering place would be considered pocket park as well.
Yes.
Okay. Well, then we're good to go here. But I do thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank
I do
you.
Have a speaker, Steve George.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. I'm Steve George. I didn't really intend to speak on this, but you intrigued me. Having just come back from 2 months in Spain and Portugal, on the issue of pocket parks, I think we're maybe missing an opportunity to negotiate with landowners, not just thinking in terms of buying property. But I would tell you, all over Spain and every city I went to, in front of storefronts, on the corners of little blocks, they had little playgrounds and little tables and things like that. So it was integrated into the entire community. And so it wasn't just public land, it was also private land. And so negotiating with Tobes, like in Newtown, Goleta, and different places in Old Town, I'm sure there are places where we could negotiate a good agreement with private landowners to put in a little playground, a little meeting place, so we don't want to miss that opportunity either. So, thank you.
Thank you. Excellent idea. Thank you. Okay, well, I guess we need a motion on this.
I'm ready to move approval of item B12.
So moved.
Okay.
A12.
Okay.
I had it right.
And I think you might need to read the recommendation, or does it need to be read again?
To authorize city manager to execute a professional services agreement between the city of Goleta and KTUNA to prepare a parks, facilities, and playgrounds master plan in an amount not to exceed $100,000 with the termination date of June 30th, 2019.
Thank you. Second on that?
Second.
Okay. Any more discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Ayes have it. Thank you.
Okay. Item B1, initiation of 2018-19 Community Development Block Grant, CDBG, and Goleta City Grants Programs.
Ms. Dato?
Good afternoon, Mayor and members of the City Council. I'm going to try not to lose my voice or break into a coughing fit. For a number of years, the City Council has allocated 15% of its Community Development Block Grant, or CDBG, funds to nonprofits providing services to low-income residents and the homeless. CDBG funds are dispersed and regulated by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, which strictly regulates the use of these funds. This year, the CDBG amount for public services is $26,500. In addition, the City Council has allocated general fund monies to fund the Goleta City Grant Program, which provides a maximum $3,500 grants to applicants sponsoring projects and programs of benefit to Goleta residents and the community. The general fund contribution to the Goleta Grant Program is approximately $75,000 per a year. A single application for both grant programs has been successfully implemented over the past 3 years. This year, the city received 59 applications for grant funding, which were reviewed by the Grant Funding Standing Review Committee, Council Subcommittee, in early 2017. Because the committee reported to Council on the difficulty of reviewing so many applications without some guidance, in June, the City Council discussed the evaluation process and potential establishment of review criteria for grant applications. In preparation for this meeting, staff watched the video for the June 6th meeting and found that council comments ranged from not wanting to see any changes on how the grants are applications are evaluated to wanting specific, clear criteria for evaluating them. Recently, staff met with the committee on two occasions to discuss the application evaluation process and other parameters of the grant programs. The committee considered draft rating forms based on what other local jurisdictions are doing and ultimately came to recommend the forms provided with the staff report as attachment one. If the new rating forms are approved, the committee recommends that corresponding changes be made to the application form. Without these changes, the application would not be soliciting all of the information that would subsequently be evaluated by the committee. Over the past few years, staff has reported to the City Council on recommended grant funding in terms of eight different categories, those being educational programs, the arts, including music, dance, theater, and fine arts, community events, services for low-income persons, services and programs for seniors, environmental, wildlife, and animal welfare programs, youth services and programs, and miscellaneous programs and services. As staff noted in the past, some applications can fall into more than one category. The committee discussed the possibility of establishing funding targets for these various categories in order to ensure a diversity of funding. The committee felt that targets, rather than strict percentages, would allow for some spending flexibility from year to year. If the council supports the establishment of targets, the committee would be tasked with developing these. The committee also discussed the minimum and maximum grant amounts. The committee felt that there should be a minimum grant amount established for the CDBG program to make it cost-effective for applicants since they are required to comply with time-consuming record-keeping and reporting requirements from HUD. Fewer larger grants would also result in more efficient use of staff's time. Conversely, the council or the committee thought it might be appropriate to raise the Goleta City grant award amount from $3,500 to $5,000. This could either be applied as a single grant maximum amount or a maximum amount applied to any single organization. Council direction is sought on these issues. Finally, the committee concurred with the previous direction from the City Council that organizations not be allowed to submit more than two applications because we routinely see some organizations submitting four to five applications for various programs. This was a rule stipulated by the City Council about a year ago, but not yet implemented. All of the committee's recommendations are summarized on pages 3 and 4 of the staff report. Staff is also requesting authorization to initiate the combined grant application cycle beginning on Thursday, December 21st, with an application deadline of January 31st, 2008. This provides a period of just under 7 weeks for applicants to obtain an application and submit it. Again, using a single application form, which includes a basic set of questions for Goleta City grant applicants and additional questions for those seeking CDBG funds. So notices of grant funding availability would be published in the Santa Barbara News Press, promoted on the city's website, and made available at City Hall. Additionally, prior grant applicants and recipients would be emailed information regarding the availability of funding for the fiscal year 2018-2019. Thank you.
Okay, I see Councilmember Bennett's light on.
Yeah, I was going over. I went over the committee's recommendations, and I felt that most of them, I think, are pretty good. I think that they're things that, in one case, like number one, the $5,000 for CDBG, I've actually recommended, you know, as you might recall, a $7,500 or $10,000 minimum, because of the requirements. And so many of the organizations, I'll use CAC as an example, I mean, they've got a staff, that's all they do is deal with federal and state grants because it is so complicated, there's so many strings attached, and they've got a staff to do it, and it's already built in, so it really works for them. Smaller organizations kind of pull their hair out, and it creates some real challenges. And they don't necessarily recognize that because they see the dollar amount as opposed to what's involved in dealing with it all. So I think that's an excellent recommendation. So I appreciate that. But I think it could be more than 5,000. 7,500 would be even better for those that would benefit. That could, you know, keeping the thought in mind that you've brought forth as a recommendation, it just seems like that would, you know, maybe plug in a little bit better. Two and three, I think are fine. I didn't have a problem with that. On item four, I guess my gut feeling on that, and maybe you can explain a little more, when you talk about funding targets, one of the beauties of this program, at least my interpretation is that when each members of the council come together for this, because it's typically changed each year. This will be the first year that it won't. But it's typically changed each year so that you've had members from the community that are far and wide and, you know, really have different opinions about what might be funded and what might not be funded. And I think that's great. I mean, because there's as many opinions as we have people in our community. So I thought that was one of the beauties of the program, that it was far-reaching. Some years it was maybe the little emphasis over here, and then other years it might be a little emphasis over there. But over time, it kind of balanced out. And, you know, it was kind of broad breadth, and I thought that really gave the strength to the process. And so that caused me to pause, and so maybe you can explain a little more so I can understand better for this funding criteria. I'm just concerned it's going to take away from some of the flexibility that we've had before.
Sure, Council Member Bennett and members of the City Council. I'll give my best shot at explaining it, and then maybe the members of the committee could also jump in. The way I understand it was that the options were either council could establish targets, or that each year the committee itself would kind of come up with targets at the beginning of the review period. And I think the idea for establishing targets was to make sure there was kind of a diversity in funding, but providing, you know, that the targets would be flexible, you know, rather than, you know, we're going to do 20, absolutely going to do 20% and seniors and 20% and youth. It's somewhat going to depend on the type of applications that are received. In some years we see a lot of, you know, applications for community events or sports-related and recreational programs. So I think there's some options there, but I don't know if I'm explaining that. I don't know if Carmen was in the meetings. I don't know if she had anything to add.
I felt like you were explaining it as we discussed.
So, I mean, one way to think of it is that right now, first of all, it won't inhibit future committees from being able to change the targets that are set aside. So let's say if we said in this year that we're going to have 20% for seniors and of the funding, 20% for seniors and 10% or 5% for sports, it's right now as we have it set up, it wouldn't mean that in 2019 they couldn't say, nah, let's change that. And we think the latter is more important, so we're going to increase that. So we haven't, it's right now, it's up to the committee itself and fairly flexible. I would say it's really kind of a work in progress. We're experimenting on it. Nothing is fixed right now. If, future councils might decide, yes, we want to establish firm targets or firm. But right now it's really committee by committee. We'll get a chance to set the allocations. We just found it when we did it last year really hard to kind of weigh the priorities of one group that, you know, some were, you know, starving kids or, you know, seniors versus sports or events, and it was hard to say, well, really, you know, can we be spending this much on something that seems so, non-life-threatening. And when you have some kind of a priori buckets, it seemed like it would help. But it won't, it'll still leave it open for the future.
I'm not finished.
Okay.
Okay, that's interesting. I would ask of staff if you would go through, given this criteria, the 8 categories, and for the 11 years that I've sat on council and participated, I would like to know what is the percentage for each of those categories for the past 11 years. That, I think, is the proof in the pudding as to whether we've been diversified or not. And I'm a firm believer, if it ain't broke, let's not try to fix something that actually has done what we're espousing that we want. And I think that the facts speak for themselves. And if we find out we've been favoring one particular aspect of our community over the others, then I would say time for review. And I would agree with that. So I don't have a problem with that. And then the item 5, which dealt with weighted, could you explain to me what that means? What's the weighted application mean?
Councilmember Bennett, in attachment 1, it shows example rating forms, evaluation forms that the committee is recommending, and the idea being that under the criteria on the first form, which is the general Goleta City grant rating form, proposed rating form, there are a number of questions that are listed, or, you know, different criterias that are listed. And the thought was that the committee might feel that some of those are more important than others, or some of those should be weighted over, you know, another criteria. So that was one thing that they were starting to look at when we were meeting. There was no conclusion on that topic. So it's just something we're bringing up for council's consideration, and that was, you know, the committee was recommending that the next committee, which is actually going to be the same committee at this point, look into whether the different criteria should be weighted in some way or just considered equally.
Okay, so I'm going to guess it comes under C, under the numbers you would apply would then define the weighting of the criteria, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Yes, for the Goleta City grant application form, it would come under item number C, and there's a list of 7 criteria that are listed there.
Okay. Again, I think the facts will speak for themselves, and I don't know what direction the facts may show, so I would be really open. I'd love to know the information, though. And whether, again, is this really needed to come up with a decision? Because from my perspective, the process has worked really well. I mean, if we were really doing something outlandish or that wasn't working, we'd have people sitting out here telling us to get our act together, because they do that in this community. It's we know when we're doing something wrong, we usually find out pretty quick. And in this instance, we usually get accolades. We usually get thank yous. We get people that are very appreciative and what have you. And so, and everyone understands we can't fund everybody. We never have, and I'm certain we never will. And it changes from year to year. So again, that's where I'm having a hard time. I'm trying to get a better understanding of, you know, how this has been put together. So I appreciate that explanation. And I don't have a problem with a 2 application maximum per organization. I'm fine with that.
Okay, if I may respond for item number 5, staff is certainly more than happy to provide that information to council. I did do something similar for the committee. I looked at the last 3 years and the funding that fell into each of those categories, and I think there were some that were kind of consistent, and then there was a few that were, you know, that kind of changed over the years. If I may, and the committee can feel free to disagree with me if I'm not summarizing this correctly, but I think the frustration has grown in that the number of applications has gone up so much. We used to get, you know, around 29, 30 applications, and then it was, you know, the next year it was 39, and now it's 59. And who knows, this year, you know, it could be 65, 70. And so the committee was really struggling to, as Mayor Pro Tem Kazin said, how do we look at these and evaluate them? You know, we've got 59 applications in front of us. what guidance do we have? And they were just really struggling with it, and I think that's where this effort was kind of born.
And that's exactly what happened. It just, mm-hmm. You know, over the years, it has grown and grown, and like Ms. Dato said, we struggled with like how to prioritize and how to, you know, it was just really, it's really getting harder and harder every year. So that's why we thought we'd try this and see if it helps the committee. And we didn't really talk too much about the weighing in at this point because we were waiting to see who the next we were going to give that to the next committee to work on. So it'll stay the same, so we'll be working on it.
Well, I guess my final comment, and then I'll shut up, is that I always felt that the leadership came from the two citizens that were appointed to the committee, because they came from very diverse places within our community, and in some instances were closer to things that they might know about than certainly I would know about, for example. And I always felt that their leadership was critically important for establishing what direction the committee might go overall and coming to their own conclusions on, you know, what they thought would be best for Goleta. So anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Well, the committee members, the citizens, are an advisory to us. We absolutely listen to them, but they were struggling as well. It was not easy for them. Councilmember Richards.
Yes, thank you. I had a few comments and questions. First of all, with regard to, and I was focusing again on the committee's recommendations on page 3 of the report. I like the idea of having a minimum for the CDBG program. I guess what I didn't have in front of me was what is the average amount of that over the last few years? Do you have an estimate or where that would normally fall? For me, looking at that, I don't know how to determine what's an appropriate minimum in this case, and also whether or not there should be a maximum in this. So do you have more information about that?
Sure. Most of the grants have fallen in the $3,000 to $5,000 range, with more often around $3,000. In some cases, it's been as low as $2,500, but $3,000 to $4,000 is usually the average amount.
Okay. So I guess my concern is, if that's the average, then to make the minimum $5,000. I appreciate the reason for why we'd be doing that, but I'm just not sure if that's the appropriate amount, and I guess that would be my question, and I'm just not sure about that. And then whether or not the committee discussed having a maximum for that as well. If we look at having a maximum for the city grant program, did that not apply to the CDBG grants then?
There wasn't a maximum discussed for the CDBG. I lost my train of thought. We have had a number of former CDBG applicants and awardees or subrecipients basically report back to us that they no longer wish to be considered for CDBG funding because it was labor intensive. They would rather, since they were only getting $3,000 to $4,000 anyway in CDBG, they'd rather apply for a $3,500 Goleta City grant and not have to have the intensive reporting requirements and ongoing monitoring that they're subject to.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, part of my reaction is that instead of making the minimum higher than what the normal grant is that we would give out, I mean, couldn't we just let them decide whether or not it was worth their while to apply for a grant at a lower amount? I mean, instead of raising that bar, we're making that determination for them that it's not worth your while to apply for a grant because of the reporting requirements. Well, shouldn't that be their decision? I guess that's my consideration. I have other things to mention, so I want to move on from that. Others can react. I'd like to hear others thinking on that. Regarding number two, I appreciate the raising the minimum of the city grants from $3,500 to $5,000. I think that to me makes sense. And for the second part, if an applicant applies for more than one grant, and I saw in somewhere here it said that we might consider limiting the number of grants for any applicant to two. So if one organization wants to apply for two separate grants, they can do that, but no more than two. However, I would say that if we allowed one organization to have more than one grant, that we increase that amount, the total amount, so that maybe that instead of having a total of 5,000, that we have a little bit more, either 6,000 or 7,000 or something like that. I think that if they had two grants of 3,500 that were worthwhile, that we should still consider that, as opposed to putting a cap of the 5,000. That would be my recommendation for that. I also had questions about the target versus the percentages, and I guess the way I'm interpreting that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that target to me sounds as if it's a kind of goal, a guideline, but not something set in stone. And so I think maybe it's a way to help the committee think about it, but not necessarily hold them to it if it doesn't make sense. And there are grants that are either that would put one category above or below the other, that would still be considered. It's just not set in stone, so that they could still go outside of those targets as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then I had a question about the application attachment one that includes the review criteria. So here we're looking at two different applications, one for the City Grant Program and one for the CDBG application. Can you tell me how these differ from what last year's applications were? Did they include those criteria that are listed here, or how did they look different?
No, we've never had application evaluation criteria before. This will be the first time that this would occur.
Okay, so the question is not only whether certain criteria should be weighted more heavily than other criteria, but whether or not we should have criteria, or whether these are the correct criteria.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, I appreciate that we have criteria that is being put forward. I think it's important to have criteria. I don't dispute that the process in the past has come up with some really good results and had very worthy applicants that have gotten really good, you know, use out of the funding. I think that it makes sense that to be as transparent as possible and to provide a tool for the committee and for the council to look at what are the ways that we're basing our evaluation on. So having criteria, to me, is good practice. All right, that was all I had. Thank you.
Councilmember Seves.
A couple brief comments. Councilmember Bennett mentioned how it's worked well in the past. And it has. In the 11 years, it's only been one time that an allocation was questioned. The rest of them was a unanimous vote. And that was the practice of this council to support the committee's recommendation. And that went on for many, many years. I totally agree that the CDBG grant should move forward. I like the criterion of raising the amount. The 5,000 is a minimum. It could be obviously more, because the application process is very onerous. The other part of that program, though, and it's not mentioned here, and I'd hope that staff would work on this as they go through the CDBG process, is that we always fall short when it comes to the public project funding. Could we allocate it to a project, and then we reallocate it to another project, and it moves around three or four times, and I use the bike path as an example, and it doesn't really seem like we're getting the projects done, and then we have timelines, we have to do it by a certain date, or we lose the funding. So I really think that staff, our Public Works Department, needs to come back with a long-term plan on where we can use that money and keep the money there so that the projects get completed. That's the second part of the CDBG program. With regards to the second part, I think we're being unfair to our nonprofits that we have funded for many years, in that, you know, I'm hearing this is a work in progress. I'm hearing that the committee had a lot of information that we don't have. And here we're asked to make an informed decision on moving forward, and I think that's unfair to us. I think it's unfair to our nonprofits. And to say that every year the committee can change it, it doesn't make sense to me. We should be working on a plan that's sustainable. The criterion sustainable. And then move forward. Because like I said, historically, we've never had a problem. Never had a problem. And finally, if you think the criterion is going to reduce the amount of applicants we get, it's never going to happen. Every year we get more applicants than we can fund. And it does become a very hard decision when we have to tell somebody, you're not getting funded this year, especially if it's a group that we've always given money to. So I would hope that this piece come back to us with the evidence provided as to help us make a decision so that the five of us could come up with a criterion, the percentages that we can now carry forward so the future committees don't have to play with it. We vetted it, and we can move it forward. So I will certainly support the first part, but the second part I would ask, and appropriate at the time, make a motion to have a table to come back to us with more information.
Mayor Pro Tem Kasdan.
So first, let me, having no explicit objective criteria where it's all subjective is not something that helps the nonprofits. What we're trying to do is develop something that is more transparent, that is more objective, and that we're doing it incrementally. So the idea that this is something that needs to be made, well, I don't know. I mean, this is, we're working towards something that gives the nonprofits something, a better understanding of the decision-making criteria that's being used. As far as the targets, the point that we were trying to do was not impose fixed amounts ahead of time that we couldn't deviate from. And I think what we were thinking about, and this is along the lines that Councilmember Bennett was raised, was we were thinking along the lines of this, that the targets we would have would be roughly based to start with on the prior year's allocation, some sort of average over the past, you know, 3 years, 5 years or something, but then also considering what the new application bundles look like. So it might have been that in the prior year's, support for seniors got 10% of the total or 10% of the applications, but this year there's a big influx of applications. Well, we might want to adjust the targets to reflect that there's some sort of additional need or additional interest. But we're, I guess the thing is that it's difficult. It would be arbitrary in many ways if we were just to impose right now or at a future council a fixed amount. This is right now going to be sort of rough averages that will guide the decision making, and not really, it's not working to uproot the previous process or completely re-engineer everything. I don't think that it's something that is kind of really changing the inherent character of either the City of Goleta or CDBG allocation or decision-making process. It's just sort of clarifying it in many ways and giving some sort of understanding to the NGOs about what we'll be deciding on or how we'll be deciding. And I think that's about it. Thanks.
I'm hoping that staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but Councilmember Richards brought up the question of two applications. And my understanding is that one organization can have two applications. They can bundle a lot of their things together into one, say arts and music, and it could be for different programs that they have going on at in their organization for $5,000. But then they can do another one for $5,000, so a total of $10,000. Am I correct on that? Or did we not? That was that.
it should be 10,000.
Yeah, Mayor.
For one organization, but they can bundle their things together. Say, I don't want to single any person out, but I'm going to. The Historical Society, they could put a lot of things into, you know, their 4th of July and their holiday and their Fiddler's Convention, and they could put that into one bundle and call it Arts and Cultural Events and apply for 5,000, and then they can go and apply for something else. So I'm correct, right?
That's correct. And the only guidance that we were looking for was indeed whether you wanted that to be two $5,000 grants, up to $5,000 grants that they would be eligible for, or if you wanted the maximum amount for any one organization to be $5,000. I think the preference was to allow, you know, up to the $10,000 for any one organization. And certainly they can group, you know, one application covering these events, maybe another application covers a different project they're working on.
Councilmember Bennett?
Yeah, I just wanted to answer Councilmember Richards' comments in regards to the CDBG. There has been a problem in the past where people have applied, or organizations have applied, excuse me, and they didn't really know what they were getting themselves into. So it's really our responsibility, because we know. And I can just say, I've tried for years to get that amount, the minimum, raised way up, because I've become very much aware of it. I sit on the CAC Commission, and I'm also on the Finance Committee. So I have a little insight on this thing. And so we have had, as the mayor has indicated, there's been people and staff has indicated, once they applied and then they found out what they had to do, it was like this nightmare. Because the feds, as you might guess, have tremendous strings. They're a huge bureaucracy, and so they demand a lot. And that's why I always have felt that the minimum amount, because of our knowledge, needs to be much higher. Many communities, I might add, cities in our own county, they allocate the entire amount of CDBG to one organization. Or maybe they split it in half between two organizations for that very, very reason. And because there's nothing worse than having an organization that applies for it and they think they know what they're getting themselves into, and then to find out later. Because there's some real, I mean, there's some real issues here that the feds can impose, like, oh, you will give it back. Well, you know how devastating that would be. I mean, I'm just saying, it's trying to really give our professional insight through our staff, that insight to the nonprofit community that may not really understand that and appreciate what that really means. And so, I said I'd like to see it 7,500. I'd like to see a minimum of 10 grand, because I think it really bespeaks for us and our professionals to guide the nonprofits. This isn't really where you want to go. I mean, it sounds, you might like all this money, but the reporting requirements are so onerous that unless you're a set up organization that has that staff that just processes this thing and you know, you can do it, then it really truly isn't something that, you know, you should be going for. You should stick with the city grants. I'm pleased to see the grants raised. I think that's an excellent idea. This will give more flexibility to those organizations that need that little larger amount. So I think between the combination of the two, CDBG raising that amount so that we get the appropriate nonprofits that can deal with the criteria, I think that's ultimately the most important part that I'd just like to emphasize.
Mayor Pro Tem Kasdan?
Yeah, just on the same topic. It was a debate, actually, that we had in the committee as far as how much, just along those lines. There were committee members who thought we should take it up to 7,500 or more, and then the opposite side of the coin was, well, we'll be able to allocate less. You know, there'll be fewer people who will get funding. And, you know, it was, I guess the assumption was sort of that incrementalism that we'll try, you know, we'll kick it up a bunch. This is just sort of inflation. We'll see how it goes. And if we can always raise it in the future, if that seems, you know, we should get some feedback also from the applicants and see what they think and you know, learn from that. And then in a future year, maybe kick it up more. But it was sort of we debated it, and this was the kind of Goldilocks. Yeah.
Councilmember Richards.
Yeah, I appreciate the background and the history on that. I think my concern would just be what was just mentioned by Mayor Pro Tem Kasdan, is that then we'd be acknowledging that there'd be fewer to give out, you know, so that's the downside. So I don't necessarily support increasing the minimum, but I think it's going to make the decisions even harder. If there are 60 applications, you know, we're basically for the, you know, the 26,500 that we have for CDBG, that would mean, you know, as a maximum of like 5 CDBG grants, and then total overall of the, you know, the 20 grants total that we'll be giving out. So I think we just, you know, I think just acknowledging that it's going to be even harder to whittle that down, and that there will be fewer recipients, even though they're getting more money. The pot of money is the same.
Well, my understanding is that we didn't have that many for grant applications in CDBG, correct?
Correct. I just wanted to respond to a couple of things, and I appreciate what Councilmember Bennett said. First of all, we normally have maybe 7 or 9 at the most applications from organizations that would qualify for CDBG funding. So usually the decision for granting the CDBG allocations is relatively easy compared to looking at the larger pool of maybe 50 applications for Goleta City grants. The other point I wanted to make is most of those applicants, even for the CDBG funding, come in requesting $10,000 or more, maybe $15,000. The way that we've been handling it is, you know, for those organizations that don't get a CDBG grant, they would still be eligible for a Goleta City grant. And the one other point I wanted to make regarding the benefit of larger and fewer CDBG grants is that the CDBG subrecipient monitoring is very labor intensive for staff as well. So, and we get, you know, a set amount of money from HUD for our administration of the program. So it's a lot more labor intensive if we have to manage 9 subrecipients over, say, 4. We've got to go out and do on-site monitoring. We have to collect, you know, quarterly financial records and do quarterly payments. And so from that standpoint, it benefits the city from an efficiency staffing standpoint to be monitoring and managing fewer applicant CDBG grantees.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. I do appreciate that additional information. There was one more question I have, and I think this is actually directed to our city attorney. The application specifies that the applicant needs to be a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And I'm aware that there are differences in various designations for nonprofit organizations, and 501c3 is one of them. Is by specifying 501c3 in particular, is that too limiting, or might there be organizations that we would want to fund that may not be specifically a 501c3?
It's possible. I don't know offhand whether the CDBG requirements require the 501c3, but there are a variety of different 501c type organizations that provide that come within the category of nonprofit, and the section under which they organize determines various things about them, including their ability to engage in lobbying or engage in politics, that sort of thing. So it is limiting it to a narrow category. That's true. I just don't know offhand if the CDBG establishes that requirement. We have obviously more flexibility.
Okay. Yeah, I just did a quick look online, and I did see that 501c4s included civic leagues, social welfare organizations that promote community welfare, charitable, educational, and recreational goals. You know, so I would just ask that, you know, I understand that maybe the CDBG program specifically might require that, but I wouldn't want to limit the city grants to that necessarily if it makes sense to broaden it. So I would just throw that out there.
We can remove that specificity. I think it was a couple of years ago that council had limited the applications to nonprofits So to my knowledge, we haven't rejected anybody for, you know, lack of nonprofit status. So, I mean, we can remove that and just simply list nonprofit. We did have one applicant a couple of years ago that was not a nonprofit that we rejected that year, but the next year they had gotten that status and they reapplied and were given funds at that point.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it should be a free-for-all and we should just let anyone apply. I think we should have standards, but I just don't want to make it too specific. And, you know, if we're allowing other, you know, groups, if it's a 501c4 to apply, then we should make that clear as well. So however we end up doing it, I just want to make sure. And I understand, too, that certain groups may have the ability to do political organizing or do other things, but I think we're specifying that is specifically not allowed with the funds that we use. So even if we give an organization that may be allowed to do that, they wouldn't be allowed to use the funding that we give them to do that. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Seves?
I'd like to make a couple of motions if you're ready to move us forward.
I see.
I just had a comment on that. I think the 501c4, the political action committees and things like that. So it's certainly,
I don't think that is 501c4.
Well, I think, you know, for instance, like Sierra Club will have the regular Sierra Club, and then they'll have the one that can that sort of thing. And if it just says a nonprofit, that's probably fine. You know, and leaves it fairly vague at that point, and then the committee can evaluate it based on what's there. But I think we have to be conscious. We don't want to be walking down the same road that we were arguing about with funds to other agencies.
I just have a quick question to clarify what I'm hearing from you, Councilmember Richards. Are you suggesting that as long as they're a nonprofit, maybe it's a one or a three or what, then yes, but if they're not a nonprofit, we should evaluate and consider whether we want to contribute money? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know enough about nonprofit law to say that. I mean, I guess I defer to our attorney.
I think what I hear you saying is that you want to open it up to all nonprofits, regardless of how they're organized. They may be organized in different ways. If that's what you're saying, then, you know, that would be okay.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Okay, so I see Councilmember Aceves.
I just had a question. They mentioned the Sierra Club and the Sierra Club PAC. So the answer is that any funds that we would give to the Sierra Club, staff would audit it to make sure that no monies that we give them would go for any political activity. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right. I mean, and because, you know, the one test is, of course, that contributions to a PAC are not tax deductible. And so that's why these organizations develop PACs, so that they can divide up their contributions between deductible and non-deductible. But our money could not be used for political purposes, so we're not maybe able to go to a PAC.
But in that particular case, they could be involved in a political activity, but that's with their PAC part.
With their PAC, right.
And so there's no, okay, so I just want to understand that. I'd like to make two motions. The first one is, because of the timeliness, I'd like to move that we initiate the CDBG grant program. And then I'll go on the second motion.
Oh, I'll second that.
Any discussion? We're just voting on A, is what we're doing.
Part of A.
He's excluding the.
I'm not excluding. I'll make a second. That's what I said. I'll make a second motion. I want to separate the two.
Okay, that's fine.
I guess I want to clarify what that entails. Does that entail the application and evaluation form that are in the packet?
For the CDBG program.
For the CDBG?
Yes.
Okay. Including the criteria that are listed therein?
I think for the purposes of the program, yes, but I think my second motion would probably clarify that.
Mayor Pro Tem Kasdan?
Well, I'll make a motion in the nature of a substitute, depending on what you're thinking of proposing.
You don't know what I'm thinking of proposing. Let me.
I'm waiting to hear. I'm waiting to hear.
We have a motion and a second.
We do
on the
have
floor.
A motion on the floor and a first and a second. So if there's no more discussion, I will call for that motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Okay.
My second motion has to do with the grant program. This one is not timely in that the funds aren't allocated until after July 1st. And I would request for me to have more information to make an informed decision. I feel we didn't get that today. We're counting on discussions that happen outside of our purview. So I'd make a motion that the community grant program come back to council in January with additional information so that we can make an informed decision. And I can make an informed decision.
And my motion in the nature of a substitute is the...
Well, let's see if we have a second.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Can I clarify? I'd like some additional clarification. What additional information you want?
Well, I'm hearing there were debates. There was information given as far as monies that were allocated in the past to help set up the criterion as percentages that only the committee was privy to. Now, we're being asked today to make a decision based on what they received, but that wasn't shared with us. So if that can come to us in January, we could still make a decision, and it would still be done with enough time to fund it with a July 1st cycle.
Okay, so are we ready to make a motion? Are we ready to take a vote?
I'm going to make a motion in the nature of a substitute.
Okay.
And let me just say that there's, in the past, there's no criteria that people have provided ahead of time to explain the basis that they were going to make decisions on. In this case, we did not have, I don't know what sort of information you're thinking that has been withheld from you, but there's not some, we don't have those targets, so we don't know what the targets are or something like that. The only thing that was suggested is that we would use as partially a guideline how much was spent in the past as a starting point, but it's not that there's some kind of fixed target or anything otherwise. We're simply saying we're going to use these as to help us in our decision-making process. So I don't think we need to bring it back for further discussion and evaluation. I don't see that there is merit to be gained, that there's additional information that you're hoping to get that would inform the discussion more. So my motion would be simply to initiate the 2018-19 application process for the City of Goleta grants.
So are you looking at B as your motion?
No, that at A, previously what we voted on was A without the phrase Goleta City Grant Program. So what we already voted on and approved was A with just CDBG. And so what I'm suggesting is, or I'm proposing, is that we have A with including the Goleta City grants.
I'll second that.
Okay.
And I would just like to say I appreciate what the request was earlier from Councilmember Bennett to have staff come back and give us a breakdown of what the categories that have been funded in the past and how that plays out. I don't think we need that information in order to move forward today. I think that information will be useful when the committee meets and, you know, decides whether or not we want to set a target. I mean, I don't think we have to do that today without having that information. That's the second part of the staff's recommendation. But I do think that moving forward today will allow the application to get published, to have this, out. And that we can stay on schedule with the, you know, and I think it's best to keep the two uniform as much as possible since we're trying to coordinate the application for both of them. I think it makes sense to, you know, keep them on schedule. And I think the way we currently had it is that the application would be available later this week and it would be due by the end of January. And if we delay this until January, then that would delay, you know, I think it would shorten the window that the applications are available or push the application out further. And I think it makes sense to keep them as coordinated as possible.
Councilmember Bennett.
Yeah, my only comment, I could be supportive of the motion
as long as the information I requested comes forward later, that's fine with me. And the reason I said that is because I'd like to see how well we've done based on wanting to make changes. I mean, it seems like all we want to do is make changes. I'd like to know the facts. I mean, if we've screwed up and we've overwhelmingly supported one faction of our community, then I would be the first to say, no, we need to change this so that doesn't happen again. And I would be very supportive of that. So I would just like to, you know, see where have we been? What's the roadmap? What is it? Have we been doing okay? And the reason I keep coming back to these kinds of things when I say, if it ain't broke, let's not try to fix it with more bureaucracy. There's no one sitting out there in the chairs today from the nonprofit communities telling us we're doing it wrong and we're not going about this correctly. It's been working. That's what I have to assume. Or we would have people here in front of us telling us we're wrong, we need to change it. And that hasn't occurred. So I will support the substitute motion, but with the understanding that we will get back that those facts so that then we can have a further discussion as we go forward.
Well, that seems certainly fair to
me. That's the last word I've got.
Okay, so I'm going to call for the vote.
My light's on. I wanted to comment on the motion.
Okay.
And Councilor Bennett, that's exactly what I was asking for, to come back in January so we can make the decision. You and I have been on this council for many years, and we've always had a practice. When a colleague asks for more information before we can vote, it comes back with more information. We have a responsibility to make a decision based on the facts. We're not getting the facts today, and that's unfortunate to the public. It's unfortunate to me, who prides myself on making an informed decision. I can't work on stuff that was discussed in the committee level and didn't rise to being presented to us, such as the information that you're asking for. So those are my comments, and obviously I will not support the motion that's presented.
Ms. Dato?
I just wanted to make a comment or have a question.
We're in debate. We're in debate on the motion.
I just wanted some clarification. The information that's being requested would be pertinent to the evaluation process, and staff is just asking that the grant cycle be initiated so that we can start notifying the applicants or potential applicants of the applications being available. And staff is more than happy to come back in January with the information requested, and that would allow council to make any further decisions prior to any further committee meetings that would be involved in the evaluation process. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you for that. Okay, so I'm going to call for the substitute motion that's on the floor. We have a first and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Opposed.
4-1. Ayes have it. Thank you. Okay, does anybody need a break or anything? We're all okay? Okay.
Item B2, Fiscal Year 2017-18, First Quarter Financial Review.
Good afternoon, Madam Mayor, members of the City Council. Before I begin, I want to point out that there was a handout that has been contains updated information. It basically, we included the budget appropriations that were approved by City Council from the December 5th meeting. One second. I'm going to go ahead and begin. You guys have the copy of the PowerPoint right in front of you. Starting on page 2 of the PowerPoint is a general overview of the general fund. Our original budget as adopted was at $24.9 million, and this was adjusted in total by approximately $9.4 million, mostly due to carryovers of the project budgets of $1.6 million, encumbrances of $4.1 million, and also additional appropriations of $3.6 million. And this is reflective of all the appropriations approved by council to date. And this covers library-related expenditures, the DRI parcel for depot acquisition, participation in the additional energy assessment, along with various professional services related to repairs and tree maintenance. So the current budget stands today at $34.3 million.
Councilmember Bennett?
Yeah, real quick before we get going, I noticed that in the presentation, the information has shrunk. You can't see it. And so it's not full screen, and I think it would be really helpful as if it would be full screen, because I don't know what it's looking like on the TV screen.
Good catch. It might be good to just take a 5-minute break on this.
Okay. Yep. This is an overview of the general fund budget. The original budget as adopted was at $24.9 million. It was adjusted in total by an approximately $9.4 million, which consisted of carryover project budgets of $1.6 million, encumbrances of $4.1 million, and additional appropriations of $3.6 million. That's reflective of all the approved appropriations to council by date. This reflects library-related expenditures, DRI parcel for the depot acquisitions, the participation in additional energy assessment, and various professional services related to repairs and tree maintenance. So as of today, our current budget stands at $34.3 million. Again, this is a table highlighting our general fund budget. Staff is recommending the following adjustments. We are recommending an increase in operating expenditures by $91,908. This is for risk management reserves of $15,200. That's related to ergonomic and computer-related technology. We're asking for an additional $76,708 from unassigned fund balance. This will go towards police services for the estimated motorcycle maintenance, fuel, overhead, and mileage that was not reflected in the original adopted budget, along with $30,000 for the corporate yard common area maintenance costs that was also not reflected in the adopted budget. We are also recommending a budget transfer for recruitment services of $25,000. This is not a new appropriation, but a budget transfer from one department to another that requires City Council approval. The chart before you displays the general fund revenues received by the city by category. Transient occupancy tax remains our largest source of revenue at 36%, followed by sales tax at 25% and property tax at 24%. This next chart provides a visual year-to-date comparison of general fund revenues through the first quarter for the last two fiscal years. In the next few slides, I will be providing a brief overview of how our general fund revenues are performing. So overall tax revenues are tracking as expected at 11.9% of the total budget when compared to last year at 11.5%. included in this table. We've added the prior year-to-date actuals through the quarter for an enhanced comparison. So our main tax revenue budget variances have been evaluated and provided in the table below is a comparison of the year-to-date actuals along with the percentages of budget of current year and prior year through the first quarter. As you can see, overall, we are tracking as expected. So moving on, we're going to give a brief highlight on our main general fund revenues. We have property tax. It's trending slightly higher than prior year. Right now, at this time, staff is anticipating an additional $200,000, and this is due to increase in transfer tax and assessed valuations. We will be reevaluating this at mid-year. We will also be meeting with our property tax consultants in the beginning of January 2018. Sales tax, it's trending in line with prior year at 9.7%. Transient occupancy tax, this is tracking as expected and trending in line with prior year at 21.5%. It should be noted that this amount might appear slightly below our original growth estimates of 6%, but that's because this does not account for all receipts received through September. Based on the latest figures through September, we are at an overall 3% growth. When you're comparing September to September, we're actually at a 6% growth. Now, since this preparation of this report, it's reflective of all receipts received through 9/30/2017. So we'll continue to monitor TOT revenues. This doesn't include the two additional new hotels that came in and started operations in October 2017. And this next slide is a general overview of our licenses and service charges category. It should be noted that during budget adoption, we made proper adjustments to the certain line items that reflect the decrease in building activity this fiscal year. We will continue to monitor revenue projections and may make recommendations for adjustments at mid-year. Overall, they're tracking as expected at 23.6% of budget. So the other revenues were tracking as expected and trending higher than prior year at 17.5%. The other revenue categories consist of interest and rent income. The revenues were at 35.2% of the budget amount, and this is mostly due to the rising interest rates, which results in our increase in investment earnings. Our reimbursements relates to the CIP reimbursement activity and is below budget due to project timing and also available staff for cost recovery. And the city has been utilizing contract staff that charges directly to the projects rather than employed staff that would, receive cost recovery from the special revenue funds. Transfer in other funds, the revenues have yet to be transferred and represent reimbursement for CDBG staff time. Again, this table right here before you summarizes the general fund, other revenue categories. Again, it's highlighted that the interest and rent income is exceeding target. So moving on, this next slide provides a general overview of all general budgeted expenditures for the fiscal year 17-18 by department. Public Works and Public Safety continue to be our largest department at 25% each of the general fund budget. This next chart provides a visual year-to-date comparison of general fund expenditures activity through the first quarter for the last two fiscal years. So in the following slides, I will provide a brief overview of the expenditure activity through September 30th. So overall, expenditures are tracking as expected at 16% of budget in comparison to 17% of last fiscal year. Again, our original budget as adopted was at $24.9 million. And it has since been revised for carryovers of $5.8 million with additional appropriations of $3.6 million, totaling expenditure budget of $34.3 million. So overall, expenditures are tracking as expected with one department exceeding the 25% level of expenditures to date. Now, this is primarily related to expenditures for support to other agencies being paid out earlier in this year, and also large one-time payments made in the first quarter, such as insurance premiums and the timing of City Hall lease payments that were remitted on time this year due to a change in property management. Last fiscal year, lease payments were processed later due to invoices being received late by the city. This next slide highlights the recommended appropriations that were addressed earlier. Police services, we're recommending a $46,708 increase. Again, that was for the estimated annual motorcycle maintenance, fuel overhead, and mileage that was not included at the original budget adoption, and support services, the $45,200, which reflect the common area maintenance cost for the corporate yard of $30,000, and also the ergonomic-related furnishings and computer technology of $15,200. And also the $25,000 budget transfer, and this is due to the recruitment services for the Deputy Public Works Director position. This next slide before you provides an overview of where we stand with our general fund reserves that are set by policy and city manager. With the recommendations, the balances will adjust accordingly and can be seen in the far right column. I want to note that not included in this presentation or staff report for presentation purposes is the another item that included $145,000 of appropriation from unassigned fund balance. With this approval, which was approved earlier today, this afternoon, the recommended or the unassigned fund balance will reduce to approximately $1.3 million and overall total fund balance at approximately $12.7 million. This next slide is going to be highlighting the revenue neutrality agreement. So the revenue neutrality agreement allocates funding to the County of Santa Barbara for sales tax at 30% of 1% revenues and property taxes shared equally. Our estimated payments for this fiscal year is $5.7 million. Our estimated total contribution is $109.3 million since city incorporation in 2002. So it was discussed at the Finance Committee meeting to provide additional information on the revenue neutrality agreement, and this chart before you provides the breakdown of Goleta's property tax dollar. Now, for every property tax dollar that's subject to Assembly Bill 8, the basic 1% that's generated in Goleta, the city itself approximately receives about 0.49 cents, or approximately 5 cents, with the same amount going to the County of Santa Barbara per the RNA agreement. This next slide highlights or breaks down the sales tax that's generated in Goleta. Now, for every dollar subject to sales tax in Goleta, the city receives approximately 70% of 1 cent, or 7/10 of a cent, with three tenths of a cent going to the County of Santa Barbara. And then the pie chart before you shows where the rest of the funds are or the rest of the percentages are allocated. I wanted to point out that overall, 6% is going to the state of California, and 1.05% is going to the county, and the city receives 0.7%. This next slide is a schedule of our historical revenue neutrality agreement contributions to the county. Again, you can see that the total amount, estimated amount, is $109,332,785. Now we are moving on to other special revenue funds. So what we've done is we've compared budget to actuals for all funds. We've analyzed and looked at the deficit fund balances for other funds, and mostly this is due to pending reimbursements that are currently in process for grant-related funds, and also the timing of receiving revenues. And we are also recommending some budget adjustments for the various special funds, and I will get into that here in a second here. The first fund here is the gas tax fund. So revenues received through the first quarter of $117,000 are tracking as expected at 16.8% of budget. This reflects revenue through the end of August due to the timing of revenues. At this time, staff is actually recommending an increase of $29,400 for a total gas tax revenue of $730,722. This recommendation is based on Department of Finance's revised estimates and are approximately 4% higher than originally adopted. I wanted to note here that these gas tax funds do not reflect the SB1 Road Repair and Accountability Act of 2017. That's will be represented in a different fund, Fund 203, and our first distribution is expected in January 2018. Measure A funds, revenues are on target at 26.4% through the first quarter of the budget estimate of $1.5 million. The variance in expenditures were the results of street maintenance-related projects in fiscal year 16-17 that were not completed but underway. The solid waste fund, we are recommending an appropriation of $40,000 from fund balance to cover costs related to Proposition 218 notification. Approximately $15,000 has spent year-to-date on mailing. In the GTIP fund, Fund 220, we're recommending an appropriation of $95,000 from GTIP fund balance to cover the entire Kimley-Horn Agreement 2016-076.1 for the on-call traffic demand modeling services. Our adopted budget only included half of the contract authority, so appropriating this additional amount will be able to cover the full contract. And then with the Sheriff Development Impact Fee Fund, we are recommending an appropriation of $8,343 from fund balance to cover the increased costs that's related to the electric parking enforcement vehicle City Council had decided to purchase on September 5th, 2017. Moving on to the Capital Improvement Program, in Attachment 4 of the staff report, we provided a CIP summary, and they have been reviewed for adequate funds at this time. In this fiscal year, we're recommending two budget cleanup adjustments for the CIP projects listed below. This includes a transfer of $38,000 from Miscellaneous Facilities Improvement Project 9069 to the Goleta Community Center Project 9067, and this is to track Goleta Community Center expenditures properly. We're also recommending adjusting revenues and expenditures down by $230,766 to the improvements to athletic field parking lot at the Goleta Community Center. Now, this recommendation is due to the actual grant award received of $269,234 from the Housing Community Development. So looking ahead, we have the mid-year second quarter coming up in February 2018, and we also have our mid-cycle budget update for fiscal year 2018-19. We will be releasing a mid-cycle budget calendar in January, and with scheduled workshops to be determined, and this will provide an update and recommendations to original revenue estimates and expenditure estimates as well. Also want to note that in January 16, 2018, we'll be presenting the audited CAFR for fiscal year 16-17, and we will have one of our auditors here to do the presentation as well. So at this time, are there any questions?
Thank you. Questions from council? Mayor Pro Tem Kasdan?
I would just say nice presentation.
Thank you.
Very graphic. I appreciate that.
Okay, I see no more questions. I too would like to thank you for a good report. Looks good. Anybody would like to make a motion if there's no questions?
Approval. I'll second that.
Okay. Any more discussion? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Thank you.
Item B3, Library Board of Trustees Stipend and Bylaws.
Good afternoon, Mayor, members of the City Council. This report recommends the City Council adopt a resolution establishing a stipend amount for the Library Board of Trustees and also adopting bylaws. On March 7, 2017, City Council adopted Ordinance 17-01, establishing a municipal library and creation of the Library Board of Trustees. This ordinance allows for the compensation of the Library Board of Trustees, but did not set an amount at the time. Staff recommends an amount of $50 per month per trustee, and this amount would be consistent with the education code, which limits it to the $50 per month. This amount is also consistent with other commissioners' compensation, and like other commissions, if a member is absent from a meeting, in this case a monthly meeting for the Library Board of Trustees, the member shall not receive the monthly compensation. The bylaws are created to serve as the board's operating manual, which includes the provisions of the ordinance 17-01 and further adds emphasis to the rules and procedures for agenda organization and agenda management. Any future revisions of the bylaws may be recommended to the City Council by the Board of Trustees. And just as an aside, this was also part of the staff report, but just to remind Council that with respect to filling the 5 Board of Trustee seats, the City Clerk, following this item, should the stipend be approved, or if there's other direction given by the City Council, the City Clerk will put out a public announcement requesting participation for the Library Board of Trustees, and we'll also reach out to the County Board of Supervisors so that they are notified regarding us needing the recommendations for those appointments. Applicants for city appointment will be interviewed by the mayor. The mayor's appointment shall be brought to the full council for its consent. The remaining 2 members shall reside in the unincorporated area of the Goleta Valley. These members shall be recommended by the County Board of Supervisors, and the mayor shall always appoint and the council shall always consent to the county's recommendation. This item did go to the ad hoc library committee. They had reviewed both reports, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Thank you. Councilmember Richards.
Thank you. I had a question about the proposed bylaws and guidelines. It's the attachment 2 in the staff report, and in particular on page 12 of the staff report, it's small page 3 of the bylaws document. There's a section there on term of office, appointment of members, vacancies. And the question I have is, it seems that the dates don't quite line up, and I just want to clarify. It says that and I guess this is a way of staggering the appointments so that at the end of the current fiscal year, one of them will expire, and then 2 at the end of 1 year thereafter, it says, which is June 30th, 2019. And then it says, and 2 at the end of 2 years thereafter, but then it says December 2020. So I just want to clarify those dates, if they should be all lined up at the end of the fiscal year, or why that last one is at the end of the calendar year.
Yeah, I cannot tell you that they'll all be lined up. Obviously, they won't be lined up if one ends, or 2 of the assignments end at 2 years of December 2020. I cannot answer why the decision came up to make it a December 2020 date. This was part of the ordinance. I don't know if the city manager might have additional information. I do not know.
Okay.
I can.
I'm sorry I didn't notice that sooner. Yeah. It just stuck out at me.
Unfortunately, I can't recall that we had a discussion about that, so I don't have an answer for why that was the date. But staff can go back, and I believe at that time our deputy city attorney was helping us with drafting that. So we'll confer with her and with our city attorney and provide you the answers.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Councilmember Bennett?
Yeah, I would agree, and I don't know that it's accurate. But what I recall is, and I thought we had some discussion on it, and maybe I'm thinking incorrectly, but this is kind of what I remember. I think the education code dictates to us how this is supposed to work. And I know that there were things in there when we were going over it that seemed kind of strange. But, you know, we can't change state law. We have to go along with the program. But I'm not suggesting that the education code says this the way it said it. But I think it related to the terms and how you establish them. That's kind of what I remember.
I apologize. I wasn't here when the ordinance was crafted. Let me have the opportunity to double check the dates. One, to confirm that December date is correct. As city manager mentioned, I'll come back to you with that information. I'll report that back to the city council and then give you any further recommendation if that needs to be changed to make it more consistent. We'll definitely check the education code for that.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? And as I have a question, as far as I'm same topic on 2.2, it's clear that if the first person, I don't know how you're going to decide who only gets 1 year, but there's no reason why they couldn't stay on another year, correct?
That's true, and that's a decision that the mayor will need to make. If the person wishes to continue their assignment, then that would be something that they would bring to the attention to the mayor. We would go through that application process, but that would certainly be something under your consideration and then upon the consent of the city council.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Bennett.
Okay, I think I heard something that always concerns me, but I will bring it up just to be clear. If we have someone who wishes to continue, and I know that for some appointments we're required by state law to advertise them anyway, we don't have a choice, even though the person wants to continue. But we've had a number of people here recently that said, I never would have applied if I knew that the person that was already there, mm-hmm. who's doing a good job, I didn't want to replace them. And they basically, that was their statement to us. So that's my only caution. If we're required to advertise, I get it. Again, the state tells us what to do and how to do it. Love the bureaucracy. But that would be something then in the process we should let others know so there isn't this confusion. In one case, I believe there was some embarrassment that they had applied, not realizing that person wished to stay. And we shouldn't put anybody in that position. I think that would be unfortunate. So they know everything. That's all I'm asking. And if it doesn't require us to advertise and the person expresses the desire, and assuming that they're doing everything correctly, then, you know, the reappointment process should, the mayor should feel comfortable in that going forward and recommending to us.
Okay. I see no more questions. So would someone like to make a motion?
So moved. Second.
Okay. Any more discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Ayes have it. Thank you, Ms. Nichols.
Item B4, Annual Review and Adoption of City's Investment Policy and Participation in CalTrust for Investment of City Funds.
We're going to do the fire.
Another break? There we go.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Mayor, members of the City Council. So I'm here today to present the annual review and adoption of the City's investment policy and participation in CalTrust. So to give a little bit of background information on the City's investment policy history, so the City initially adopted the investment policy on June 20th, 2005. It was last revised on September 20th, 2016, and this included an annual review requirement, which was a recommended best practice. We've also added that regional broker-dealers be included along with waiving collateral requirements for portions of deposits that are insured by the FDIC, which is currently at $250,000. Our policy meets the California Government Code statutes and best practices from the California Debt and Investment Advisory Commission, CDAC, which is a state commission, the California Municipal Treasurers Association, CMTA, which is a professional society of active public treasurers of California county, cities, and special districts, and the GFOA, the Government Finance Officers Association. So the City's investment policy purpose, this investment policy is intended to establish guidelines, strategies, practices, and procedures to be used in investing public funds. This ensures the City is in conformance with all California government code sections 53600 and 53635 and local statutes governing the investment of public funds. The policy objectives are safety, liquidity, and yield. Safety is the likelihood that the city will get all of its money back. The liquidity is the city's ability to withdraw funds on short notice. And the yield is the interest or other return on the investment. City's investments, the current practice. So our city's investments are currently held in a collateralized money market account with Community West Bank. Our contract rate is at 0.7%. And recently, Community West Bank has agreed to match LAIF and PMIA average monthly yield. So our current rate is 1.1358%. We also hold funds in the local agency investment fund, LAIF. This is part of the pooled money investment account, PMIA. This is managed by the investment division of the state treasurer's office. LAIF allows cities, counties, special districts to place money in a major portfolio. And at no additional cost to taxpayers, they use the expertise of investment division staff. Now, the city can withdraw from LAIF at any time. At the end of November, the LAIF fund had 2,433 participating agencies and a balance of $20.3 billion. Now, the current LAIF distribution yield is 1.08%, which is adjusted quarterly. So the recommended updates to the investment policy include the following: amendments to Section 5A, Authorized Investments. Staff is recommending to include the Investment Trust of California, a joint powers authority doing business as CalTrust, under the list of authorized investments as item number 8. We are also recommending amendment to Section 14, Duties and Responsibilities. And this is updating the language, title and change from duties and responsibilities to delegation of authority, and include additional language to clarify the authority of investment activities, and that the delegation of authority be in effect for one fiscal year and may be renewed annually by City Council and may revoke the authority at any time. We've included a copy of the recommended changes in redline format in Attachment 1 to the staff report. To give a little bit of background information on CalTrust, we put together a few slides here that's going to give a general overview. So the CalTrust is the Investment Trust of California. It's a joint powers authority that was formed by a number of public agencies in 2005. Currently, there are 130 participants with $2.7 billion in holdings. CalTrust provides efficient, convenient, and professionally managed investment solutions and safe methods of pooling funds that achieve economies of scale. CalTrust is governed by an experienced board of trustees consisting of California public agency investment officials and policymakers. There are four account options that all comply with limits and restrictions placed on public agency investments. The investment manager of CalTrust is BlackRock Financial Management. The custodial services are provided by U.S. Bank. The program administrator is CSAC Finance Corporation. And it should also be mentioned that CalTrust is co-sponsored by the League of California Cities. Moving on to the CalTrust investment options. So CalTrust strictly invests in fixed income securities that are eligible for local agency investments pursuant to government code. There are no minimum investment required to participate or maximum amount for any of the following CalTrust funds they offer. The table before you kind of highlights the type of funds they have. They have a government fund, money market fund, short-term fund, medium-term fund. They are completely transparent with all investment holdings in each fund, and they make available on their website a complete list of all bonds, fixed income securities of what, you know, each fund contains in their portfolio. I want to point out too that all the funds have an S&P rating in the A category. You'll notice the AAA M rating that demonstrates that they have the extreme strong capacity to maintain the principal stability, and there's limited exposure to principal losses due to credit risk. That is the highest rating category for that type of fund. And the other funds have a AA rating and an A rating, and those represent credit qualities of the fund's portfolio. Exposure is very strong and strong.
Councilmember Richards, do you have a question?
Real quick question. WAM, can you clarify?
Oh, weighted average maturity.
And what is that?
So that's the duration, or that's actually the calculation of the investment yields. So say if you had a combination of a CD at 9 months and a bond at 2 years, and depending on the amount of funds held, that gives you what the weighted average maturity is for those funds held.
Okay.
Moving on here to the principal risk of investing in CalTrust. This next slide provides a general overview of the risk of investing in CalTrust. The primary risks are associated are interest rate risk and credit risk. Due to the flexibility of these funds, the liquidity risk is very minimal as the city can withdraw its money immediately. So the interest rate risk, that basically means it's the potential for a decline in bond prices due to rising interest rates. Generally, bond prices vary inversely with interest rates. So the change in bond prices will depend on several factors, including the maturity dates. Bonds with longer maturities are more sensitive to changes in interest rates than with bonds with shorter maturities. So basically, the CalTrust medium-term fund will be more sensitive to interest rate changes than those with shorter average portfolio maturities, such as CalTrust short-term fund. The credit risk, that's the possibility that a bond issuer will fail to make timely payments of interest or principal on its outstanding bonds. And also a decline in a bond issuer's credit rating or credit worthiness that may also cause prices for outstanding bonds to decline. I also wanted to point out here that the overall the risk associated with CalTrust funds are very similar to what the city is exposed to when utilizing LAIF. So some of the CalTrust advantages, why staff is recommending this program, is that there's flexibility. You get the same day, next day, and 3-day liquidity. There's unlimited number of transactions per month with next day liquidity with short-term funds. You get weekly transactions per month with 3-day liquidity with the medium-term funds. CalTrust also allows for pooling of resources. They give out monthly distributions and the reinvestment of interest earnings automatically, and this, by doing this, will lessen finance staff's resources that are required to, you know, for investment management, and ultimately this achieves economies of scale. Now, the larger pool creates greater diversity of holdings, leading to more frequent periodic interest payments. Monthly statements are provided as well, and a 24-hour password-protected account for information will be online as well. There's no cost to the city to participate. As with LAIF, all expenses associated with CalTrust are deducted from the investment yield. And then also the benefit is the medium-term investment option, which LAIF does not currently offer. On this next slide, I thought I include this for presentation purposes to show that CalTrust also provides monthly market updates on its funds and holdings, and also a comparison to benchmarks. I'll get into this here in a little bit more on the next slide. So the CalTrust investment program here, the following is a table that includes rates earned by CalTrust investment funds in comparison to LAIF through November 30th, 2017 on an annualized basis. You can see that the government fund, a money market fund, and have over time, well, pretty much all funds over time have been increasing steadily over the years. You can see it in comparison to LAIF. The short-term fund is the fund that is benchmarked against LAIF, and you can clearly see that the short-term fund has increased basis points. So the CalTrust fiscal impacts, as mentioned before, there are no fiscal impacts. It's very similar to LAIF. This will allow for additional options and additional yield without assuming increased risk. So at this time, staff is only recommending the participation in the CalTrust program and not funding CalTrust just yet. The funding strategy will be determined at a later date. We'll be evaluating our cash flow forecast, and it will be brought back to the Finance Committee. Now, due to the liquidity nature of CalTrust, I just want to point out that the city will continue to meet its expenditure requirements for the next 6 months, regardless of the amounts that we end up holding in CalTrust. So the recommendation at this time is to adopt the resolution amending the city's investment policy and rescinding the resolution number 16-25, which was last fiscal year's investment policy, to include the additional changes, and also adopt the resolution authorizing the city manager to execute the necessary documents to join CalTrust. I just want to point out, to participate, only a program registration form and participation agreement must be completed and submitted. Does anyone have any questions at this time?
Member Tim Kasten.
Thank you. So just a couple of things. So with the first one, I just wanted to clarify, the medium-term fund, that also has liquidity associated with just several days, 3 days or so. So there isn't any here that is longer than sort of minor amounts of time.
Right, that is correct.
Does CalTrust or are there other funds available that have less liquidity and, you know, other similar sort of JPIAs, et cetera?
To my knowledge, I know there is another pooled investment account called CAMP. I believe it's a California Asset Management Program, but they're also very liquid. And that's the benefits of having these types of pools. You know, the medium-term fund tends to invest in longer-term or, you know, medium-term securities. And that's why they're able to take on a little bit more risk and yield a little higher over time. But if we wanted to lock up our money and say something like we could reach out to broker-dealers and have our own bond funds that we selectively choose, that's another option, and also getting certificates of deposits as well.
So is it the requirement that they be fixed income sort of thing, is that in state law, or is that where is the source of that, our internal Goleta policies, or where is that?
That is state government code. Yes,
state
that is
government
correct.
Code. Mm-hmm. And just for my own sort of entertainment, so does that exclude things like, you know, sort of real estate, you know, the rate and things like exchange, you know, spiders, exchange traded funds, and all those, you know, other kind of things that are.
Well. Right. Yeah. It's strictly fixed income securities. So those types of funds will not be invested in.
And does the medium term include U.S. Treasuries? Oh, it does, doesn't it? Well, it has a government index. Does it have U.S. Treasuries in there?
They do have a portion of U.S. Treasuries. So I'm trying to think. I don't think it was included in the staff report, but on the CalTrust website, they do provide updated information on all its holdings and also provides a breakdown of the types of holdings within its own fund.
I mean, partly the reason I ask this, and, you know, this is my sort of amateurish economic analysis, well, more than amateurish, but it's if the tax bill goes through, it's going to ultimately lead the Fed to impose higher interest rates to offset the stimulus effect of the tax bill, and that is going to have a detrimental effect on bonds. And so I was just wondering, as far as you know, if we think that bonds might not be treated well going forward, what options we sort of have.
So that's where, like, the short-term fund comes in. If you pull the latest reports and compare the two, you actually see that the short-term fund, the distribution yield was a lot higher than the medium-term fund. I have the latest numbers here right in front of me here. The yield for the short-term fund was 1.87%. LAIF was 1.17%.
Wow.
And the medium-term fund was 1.59%. So normally, you know, since the interest rate, the market, the interest rate environment, as interest rates start slowly to creep up, the medium-term fund, you know, they're holding on to bonds, and they're not as performing well as the short-term funds.
Yeah. Okay. So, and one last thing. You had mentioned on page 7 it said you guys had done some research associated with other cities and the types of investments and so forth. Is there like a table or something or some sort of thing that you could share with us at some point? What they are doing and how they're...
Yeah, we can bring that back to the Finance Committee. So what we've done is that we reached out to cities that were identified as comparable from another report that was done on wages. And so what we did was took those cities, you know, and populated, basically taking their investment yields for May 2017. We actually reviewed the type of investments they each held, and also look to see, you know, if they had a treasurer's department, if they were utilizing investment advisors, and if they were a participant of CalTrust. What we found was no one city was alike. There was a huge, broad range. We found that the approximate average of was 1.1%, and some used investment advisors, some used none at all. Some just kept it in LAIF, some kept it just strictly in their bank accounts. So there was a combination of it all. But just given the size of our staff and the flexibility CalTrust has, and that there's no cost to the city, we feel like this is an excellent option. And, you know, we're certainly willing to also reach out to broker dealers here later down the line, you know, if we choose to do so. You know, we'll be monitoring this closely, and updates will be provided to the Finance Committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Councilmember Richards.
Thank you. Thank you for this report. I'm very excited to see us pursuing this. I think this will be a good change, and I appreciate the fact that we're, you know, looking at diversifying at least our options in the short term. Maybe we'll actually put money there someday. Yeah, that would be nice. I want to a question I had in particular regarding the issue of diversification is in the staff report on big page 17, which is actually included as the revised investment policy, the proposed revised investment policy. And there's a section there on diversification, and it says that no more than 10% of the value of the city's portfolio would be placed in any single issuer. And then there are some qualifications there, including the, I see, collateralized investments. And can you explain that? So right now, you know, all of our investments are either with LAIF or with the Community West Bank.
Yeah.
Like mostly with Community West Bank and a smaller, much smaller percentage with LAIF. Can you walk me through that, what that means, and how diversified are we if you know, like $40 million right now is with one bank?
Yeah, so right now, if you take a look at our portfolio, the majority of our holdings are with Community West Bank. And what that necessarily means that we have it all in their money market account, and that is a collateralized investment, meaning it's insured. They're required to do that, and they, you know, and given in terms of diversification, we've kind of lack, you know, largely in that area. But then you also got to look that it's also collateralized. So it's one of those things. Investments held in LAIF are not collateralized, and investments held in CalTrust are not collateralized.
But, okay, so in terms of security and how safe that money is then, you know, is it, can you walk me through as a layperson, okay, collateralized, what does that mean? And how does that, what does that mean for us, I guess? Can you explain this?
Yeah, so basically what that means is that if there was like a run on the banks, the money that we hold with Community West Bank is insured. That we're not going to lose, you know, whatever. What, say, for instance, we have a contracted amount. Say if interest rates started declining, we have a contract amount at 0.7%, and it can never go below that. Even if the interest rate environment was, you know, really detrimental to the economy, we will, you know, have those. We will not lose any of those funds.
Okay. And is that FDIC insured, or is that insured somehow else?
It's by the Federal Home Loan Bank. It's insured.
Okay. Yeah. I just going back to your report on your presentation on page 2, it mentions that regional broker dealers are and waive collateral requirements for a portion of deposit insured up to amount of $250,000. So how does that relate to this discussion about the money in that account?
Are you referring to the staff report or
the presentation that's up on the screen, page 2? It's
yes. So what that means was, so in 2016 we actually had some broker dealers take a look at our investment policy to make sure that, you know, it's been updated, and there was some old language in there because right now the FDIC does insure deposits up to $250,000.
Okay. But we are insured for much more than that. Our account is.
Right. This was strictly aimed towards certificates of deposits, or if we were to open up a separate interest-bearing account with another banking institution or with a broker-dealer. But this is for broker-dealers, it was more so with certificates of deposits.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is not what we have. We have money market.
It's we have money market account.
All money market. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Councilmember Bennett?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that the ability of local governments for investments was drastically modified in the early 90s because of the Orange County bankruptcy. And there was much more flexibility back then than there is today. And that's a result of the millions and millions of dollars that ironically were invested in Orange County from communities all over the state of California. Which just sounds a little weird, but Orange County had all that, and they went bankrupt, and there was a whole lot of liability with a whole lot of governmental entities that had invested with Orange County. So there was a lot of cleanup legislation that then directed what we can and can't do.
Okay. Councilmember Seves.
Just a quick note. The Finance Committee spent a lot of time on this, and that's why we didn't develop the strategy just yet, because we wanted staff to come back with a risk analysis as to what and where we can do it, and also to look at our peers, not only financially, but also for the size of our cities. So that's why we purposely left that out for a future meeting to come back for council. So having said that, I move staff's recommendation.
Second. Okay. Any more discussion? All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Ayes have it. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
Say, Mayor, I apologize for interrupting, but before you move on to the next item, could we digress for a moment back to item three? It was a good catch by Councilmember Richards. I believe that it is a mistake in the bylaws of the Library Board, Section 2.2, that the terms of the final two members end in December of 2020. That's a misinterpretation of the statute. I've pulled up the statute, and in fact, that should read June of 2020. And so with your indulgence, we can just treat that as a typo and make that correction and move on.
I'm seeing heads okay. nodding. Is that appropriate?
All right. Sounds good. Then we don't have to see it again. So June 30th, 2020 is what it should
right.
say.
Right. The idea was that there would be staggering so that the first person would end June of 2018, the next two at 1 year thereafter, and the next one 2 years thereafter.
Makes sense.
And I think whoever wrote it thought that 2 years thereafter meant 2 years from today. So.
Ah.
It's, okay. it's, we'll correct that in the reso. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So we're moving on.
Item B5, annual financial report of the City of Goleta's development impact fees.
That's you again, huh, Luke?
We'll also be having Marty Milan
okay.
joining us.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Mayor and Council members. This afternoon, we have before you the annual financial report of the City of Goleta's development impact fees. The City of Goleta collects several types of impact fees, and as shown in the Exhibit 1 of the resolution, they include Goleta Transportation Improvement Program Fund, or the GTIP, it's commonly called. We have three different types of park fees that we collect: the park development impact fees, the Quimby fees, which are associated strictly with subdivisions, and park development impact fees. The first park development impact fees being the residential development, and the second being commercial and industrial. Then there are public administration facility fund, and the library facility fund, and the police facility fund, and the fire facility fund. All of these fees collected through development provide for city services. As a requirement of AB 1600, or the Mitigation Fee Act, It is responsibility of the city to report on an annual basis how these fees are collected, anticipated to be expended, and what actual expenditures have occurred. The fee resolution provides that in Exhibit 2 in detail on each of the different funds. As I've described, the different funds are all subject to AB 1600 and the Fee Mitigation Act. However, Quimby fees are slightly different and governed by the Subdivision Act and are not required to be reported on. But as a matter of transparency, the City of Goleta does include it in its reporting. The Exhibit 2 contains a combination. One of the funds has a spreadsheet that shows how each of those funds are collected and expended. The information in that is that no loans, refunds, or allocations pursuant to our government code sections were made from any of the funds during the reporting period. The balances represented the fees collected as well as how the city plans to use the fund balance in each of those programs. And this has also been provided as in the adopted 5-year capital improvement program. So this reflects that as well. So if there are any questions that go with this, I would do my very best to answer them.
Questions from council? Oh, I see no questions. Okay, somebody would like to make a motion?
Sure. Move approval.
Okay. All right. Any more discussion? All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Ayes have it. Thank you so much for that report. Okay. That takes us to council comments and committee reports. So I think I started with you, Councilmember Richards, last time. So I will start with Councilmember Esteves.
No report.
No report? Okay.
So
Mayor Pro Tem?
Yes, thank you. So I had one request to ask, and this is with respect to the Old Town parking situation. And that is that we're now adding a requirement that, or we're enforcing parking code, and this will be going on to a greater and greater degree in some ways. And what we don't want to cause a hardship for the workers who live in the area. We've recognized that one of the most significant users of the parking in Old Town are workers from out of the area who come and park there. And we don't want to cause hardship for them, but nor do we want to see a situation where they have to every hour and a half hop out of their businesses and move their cars a block and have, you know, cars constantly in motion looking for parking spaces in the area or clogging up our very expensive parking that we just purchased. So what I would propose is that we survey, in a sense, the those businesses in the area and the workers inside to find out, number one, where are they coming from and are they going, how much they're going to be affected by this policy, and number two, are they aware, for instance, what are they planning to do? Have they considered how they're planning to respond to the new policy? Are they aware of it? And number three, are they aware of the options that exist, the alternative, the various alternative transportation plans, mass transit, carpools, and any other resources that might be available? Have those been made known to them? And if not, can we educate them about it? But just to give ourselves and give them, give ourselves the information that we need to make decisions and give them information so that the workers can make decisions. So I'd like to see that neighborhood services take on trying to, it's not that many businesses, if they can try and figure that out.
Okay, I don't know who was first. Councilmember Bennett.
My only comment would be is I was recently in conversation with some of the folks that are involved with the Old Town Business Association, and I don't want to misrepresent them, but I believe they were saying that they've done just what you suggested, that they made contact with the respective businesses in Old Town to get a feel for this. And if you recall, we had brought to the attention of council, which was at our committee meeting as well, the potential for providing some parking spaces that might be available on the airport property. And apparently there is some expressed interest in that regard based on this interaction. So
I guess
I'm thinking that, you know, business might be in the process of taking care of this themselves, and we could certainly assist, but I don't know that it's an initiative for us to dive into other than make an inquiry and maybe define what it is they found out or what they're thinking or whatever the case might be.
Well, I'm certainly not suggesting if the work has already been done that we redo it or duplicate it in any way. If the information, that sort of survey information is already completed, you know, wherever the source is, whether it's us or whether it's others, great.
Councilmember Seves?
I understand we're not agendized to discuss this, but I just want to remind council that the ordinance committee is covering this issue. We're going to have public meetings at night at the community center. So there'll be more vetting. I thought we covered that when we did the parking restrictions, but just as a reminder, it will be a public process and an evening session.
Just a point of clarification, it's the Public Safety Committee, not the Ordinance Committee, that
you're right,
that met to discuss
since,
this.
Since,
it is.
Since we're on both, I was confused. You're right, it was Public Safety.
Well, I think that's great. I'm not going to go on and on about it, but I think if it's already been done, let's check into that, and then with the meetings.
But if it's not been done, I think we need to do it.
It's the process. Nothing's been done yet.
But there's a difference between having a committee meeting.
We're not going to, I'm going to stop this right now. I will agree to look into seeing if this has been done already, and if not, encouraging the Old Town Association to do it and see what they think, what they say. That's where I'm coming from. Let's start there. I'm not saying we can't come back.
Well, if it hasn't been done, then instead of encouraging them, maybe we could take the initiative to do it. Is that?
Or we could compliment them and do it as well.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Do you have anything else to report?
No.
Nothing? Okay. Councilmember Richards?
Well, seeing as most of everyone's meetings have been canceled the last few weeks, the only thing I have to report is just going to several of the daily fire briefings at 4 p.m. at San Marcos High School, which have been very informative.
Very.
And ones that I couldn't make, I've watched online, and it was great to have that resource. So, again, thank you to all the crew and personnel who mm-hmm. are working their heart. Thank you.
Councilmember Bennett.
Yeah, I too had many meetings that were canceled and what have you, but we did, on the library committee, interview the library consultant that the county has hired. So we had an opportunity to interact with them and get some information going forward. And that was on Thursday, December 7th. And as I scroll through everything in here, everything has been canceled, so that's that's what's going on. And I would just say that I too have been attending the briefings, the fire briefings at 4 o'clock at San Marcos High School. And once again, I offer up, I think this is just an excellent decision that was made, and I know how difficult that makes it when everyone's trying to work on the fire activity, and of course you want the experts there to talk, and that pulls them away from that opportunity. But it's really important, and they did it well. So thanks again.
Okay, well, I too have many things canceled, but we did meet with the legislative ad hoc committee, and that will be coming back for full council to look at proposed changes. That same afternoon, I met with what I call the lovely ladies of Encina Royale. They invited me to a holiday tea, and I mainly was there to ask them questions about how they've joined and how they've gotten together over the years, and it was amazing to hear their stories. And they've been meeting twice a month for many, many years, and it was a really, really nice event. Then, of course, the Library Ad Hoc Committee, that was discussed today, what we talked about, MTD board meeting. Also attending I have the advantage of attending the 11 o'clock for elected meet briefings in the morning, so I've been doing that and then going to the afternoons whenever I can. And I think something that I wanted to take away from that is something that Suzanne Gramercy said to all of us, is that, you know, our community is in a lot of stress right now, so be kind to yourself and to be kind to others. And I thought that was really, really good advice right now. And that's all I have.
Madam Mayor and council members, I do have a handful of items. First, I wanted to make sure that council is all aware that last week staff went to the SB CAG sub-regional committee to talk about our request that they be a co-applicant on our TRSIP grant for the Goleta Depot project. And I'm proud and happy to report that they supported our request. So we are moving forward with that grant opportunity. So in the next few weeks, staff will be working hard, even through some of the holiday period, to get our application packet finished. And it's due, I think, January 12th. So we're moving forward on that. Also, with respect to the holiday period, we do have a closure of City Hall, where all offices will be closed to the public from this Friday, December 22nd through January 1st. So we will not have our doors open to the public. However, we will be continuing with the N95 mask distribution at the community center through Saturday, and here at City Hall through this Thursday. So I know there are still some people who are suffering from the ill effects of the smoke and ash, so if they need masks, we will have those. Finally, since the Old Town Holiday Parade had to be canceled due to smoke and ash, I wanted to let council and the community know that there's still going to be some of the activities that the group had planned for that day occurring at the community center this weekend. Let's see, 5 to 9 p.m. At the community center on Saturday, I believe. So, actually, no, I gave you the wrong date. It's this Wednesday, December 20th from 5 to 9 at the community center. So they'll have games, activities, and Santa will be appearing for the kids. So that's an effort between the Goleta Old Town Community Association and the Goleta Valley Community Center. So again, Wednesday the 20th. Sorry for the wrong info there. That's all I have.
Ms. Green, is there a number that, I don't know if you have it up top of your head, that if there's an emergency or somebody wants to get a hold of somebody at the city directly,
sure.
Could you give out that number?
They can call our main line, 805-961-7500. They will be able to leave a message, which will picked up during our closure period. We always have staff available to check that line. But it's important that those messages need to be for non-emergency items. Correct. So if anyone has a real emergency, they need to call 911 because they won't get a live person. But we will be checking messages.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Jenkins.
I'm going to break with precedent and actually give you a short report tonight. I apologize for that. Councilmember Richards had expressed the concern last week that we hadn't been providing much in the way of information to the public about the Venico situation. And so I thought I would just take a couple of minutes and just give you a little bit of information on five separate subjects And then we'll also put something up on the city's website so folks can read it. First, the status of Venico. Venico's bankruptcy has not yet wound up, so that is still ongoing. There are still motions being made, properties still being sold through the bankruptcy court. I'm not exactly sure when that will terminate. It was originally supposed to terminate in October, but it is still ongoing. So, but they will at some point soon be done, and then they'll be completely out of business. With respect to the two pipelines that are in the city, one fully in the city, old pipeline 96, and the other partially in the city, the new line 96, we have been talking to company Allenco about taking another stab at decommissioning old line 96. We have an inspection scheduled on Thursday of this week with their representatives, and they're going to take a look at it, and we are going to negotiate an agreement with them, I believe, in the next few weeks that will call for them to come in and basically take out or vacuum out all of the liquid that's in the pipe and regrout it so that the grout sets properly. And once that's done, it'll be safely decommissioned. So that's what's happening there. With respect to the new line, that it's primarily in the county has undertaken the responsibility for decommissioning that line, and it has hired a contractor to do that, a contractor named C.D. Lyon, and the county has put in a claim in the bankruptcy court for just over $608,000 in order to obtain funds from Venico's bankruptcy to finance that. With respect to the EOF, nobody has bought it as of now from Venico. I can't imagine why not, but nobody has bought it. Consequently, its ownership at this point is going to be uncertain until Venico winds up the bankruptcy. But the State Lands Commission fully intends to use the EOF in connection with the plug and abandonment process of Platform Holly. And so it will be in the hands of the State Lands Commission and its contractor, Beacon West, for the next several years while they do the plug and abandonment process. And the State Lands Commission is currently negotiating with Venico the terms of its use of that property for that purpose. Speaking of Platform Holly, as you know, ExxonMobil has stepped up and has committed to plugging and abandoning those wells, and the state, or at least the majority of those wells, the State Lands Commission is still negotiating an agreement with ExxonMobil relative to all of the details associated with plug and abandonment of those wells, so equipment needs, costs, et cetera, et cetera. It's obviously a very complex project and undertaking. It was supposed to start in the first quarter of 2018, and I think that that's going to be delayed. Councilmember Richards indicated that he thought it might be a good idea to ask the State Lands Commission to do another one of those public town hall meetings. We'll raise that with them and try to set something up in the first quarter of 2018. I think once some of these issues settle and we have a greater sense of certainty about where they are, it would be a good time to do that and let folks know exactly what's happening. So that concludes my report.
Thank you for all that information. I just like to wish everybody a safe and happy holiday, and we will be back in 2018. And with that, we're adjourned. I know.